Good morning. I call to order the 73rd meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingard. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
I'm Jack Schreiber in Morris County, Creole.
I'm Mimi Ladslau from Persephone in Morris County.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Spartan County, Freeholder.
Scott Whitenack, public member from Morristown.
Bill Cocker, Mayor of Chester Township.
Tracy Carluccio, public representative, Hunterdon County.
Glenn Petrano, Sussex County, Freeholder.
Eric Peterson, Hunterdon County, Freeholder.
And on the phone we have?
Tim Dillingham, I'm a public member from Mercer County.
Anyone else on the phone? We do have a quorum present. I think we're expecting at least one or two other members to join us during the course of the meeting. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and was publicized on the Council's website. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
To the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Councilmember Keisha Wade, welcome. We have in our packets minutes from our last meeting 2 weeks ago. A motion to approve the minutes.
Move. Second.
Comments, questions on the minutes of June 26th? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Minutes carried. I just want to outline our schedule for the next little while, which I think members are aware of. Our next scheduled meeting after today is a week from today, next Thursday, July 24th.
17th.
July 17th. Thank you. July 17th, next week. And that meeting is also at 10 o'clock in the morning. It will not be held here. It will be held at the Givenhuysen Arboretum in Morristown so that we can accommodate more people should more people want to attend that meeting. The Meadowlands was unavailable, so be careful. And at that meeting, we are expecting to vote on whether or not to adopt regional master plan for the Highlands. Our next meeting after that, after the meeting next Thursday on the 17th, will be the following Thursday, June 24th, also at 10, I believe. And the agenda at that meeting will be largely or perhaps entirely to approve the minutes of the meeting of the 17th, so that the process of the governor's review of our action at the meeting on the 17th can commence. Contrary to some expectations, the council does not cease to exist at that moment, but continues with many more functions, and our next meeting after that on July 24th is on August 21st, which is also at 10, which will be back here. That's okay. Other members have items they wish to mention at this point?
John, you said all of the date in August?
21st, I believe.
Is that the only meeting
in August? I believe it is.
Currently?
Sorry, yes. Then we'll turn to the executive director's report, Eileen.
I'll be very brief. I'm sure you're glad. I think you all know what we've been up to. We are continuing to work on the regional master plan to get it in a form that would be ready for your consideration for the 17th and subsequent to that for release publicly, if that is what you decide to do. In terms of outreach, we have cut back on our meetings simply because we're very focused on responding to Council's direction in terms of the plan. For June 27th, we did attend and do a presentation at the Law International Seminar in Woodbridge, New Jersey. They did a session on regional planning and had Bob Siberia from the Netherlands, and we were there to talk about the Highlands. June 30th, we had a meeting with Borealis, and Borealis is an applicant that we've been working with for some time now. So we were continuing our discussions on redevelopment designation of a site in Mansfield Township, Warren County, that the council will ultimately decide upon. Other than that, it's just been working on this plan, and so I'm back now.
We have no committee report. Does someone else just join us on the phone?
Debbie.
Say that again, Debbie? Okay.
Debbie.
Hi, welcome. Okay, we have, I believe, two local planning grants before us to consider. For those keeping count, this will be the 10th and 11th towns, municipalities that have applied for grants to consider how to go about the process.
The first of the two grants before you this morning for initial assessment to consider plan conformance is from Bloomsbury Borough in Hunterdon. This is the first grant that Bloomsbury has requested from the council. The borough is 625 acres and is 100% within the preservation area. And they are seeking the grant in the amount of $15,000 for that initial assessment.
Second. Any public comment on this resolution? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
The second grant is from the township of Lopatcong in Warren County. Lopatcong had a co-grant for $7,500. That was granted 10/6/2005. Payment was issued on that grant, and the grant is closed, successfully closed. The TDR grant, they also have a TDR feasibility grant in the amount of $25,000, which was granted to them 6/22/2007. They have received 50% payment on that grant, and they received that payment November 29th, 2007, and their progress to date has been satisfactory on that feasibility grant. They are today applying for initial assessment in the amount of $15,000. They have 3,673 acres in the planning area, 1,051 acres in the preservation area.
Is there a motion? Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? Public comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Abstentions? Okay. That passes. Thank you. We turn now to the regional master plan discussion. Let me mention for the people on the phone there, I think we may have all council members present. Kurt Olsen has arrived, and 11 people here. Janice, I'm not sure if Janice is on the phone. So we have all but Janice in attendance one way or another.
We're going to use a PowerPoint today to guide the discussion, and we're just asking staff right now to email it to Tim and Debbie. I don't know if you have access to a computer, but we'll email it anyway. And as is our practice, this PowerPoint will be posted on the web as soon as possible after the meeting. We try to do it the same day. It may be tomorrow, depending on how long this meeting lasts and other issues. So for purpose of the discussion today, the first matter before you is a discussion on the plan endorsement petition to the Office of Smart Growth State Planning Commission. The Highlands Act Section 8 requires that within 60 days of adoption of the Regional Master Plan, the Council shall submit the Regional Master Plan to the State Planning Commission for plan endorsement for the planning area. The preservation area does not have to go through that process. The State Planning Commission doesn't have jurisdiction over the preservation area. That's entirely within the purview of the Highlands Council. But obviously what staff are trying to do here is, in anticipation of possible adoption of the RMD, we want to be ready to proceed with this. In accordance with Section 69, this is the part of the Highlands Act that speaks to the fact that the preservation area is exempt from the process. What staff want to do is to be ready to do this application as soon as possible after the adoption of the Regional Master Plan, We do not intend to wait for 60 days, but to start that process immediately should the council adopt the regional master plan. And one of the reasons why endorsement of the regional master plan by the State Planning Commission is so important is that the benefits that flow to plan endorsed communities automatically will flow to planning area communities that choose to conform to the regional master plan. They don't have to go through the endorsement process. Once we have been endorsed by the State Planning Commission, they are automatically eligible for those benefits upon achieving plan conformance. On December 19th, 2007, the Council, the State Planning Commission and the Office of Smart Growth signed an MOU in support of developing a cooperative planning process. That MOU helps us in going through this plan endorsement process. The current PE plan endorsement rules and guidelines address similar requirements for county and regional plan endorsement petitions. On June 16th of 2008, the State Planning Commission published proposed plan endorsement rules with a 60-day comment period, and those rules include criteria for special resource area plans. The Regional Master Plan Plan Endorsement Petition, in accordance with that MOU that we've mentioned, has been waived from certain PE or Plan Endorsement Petition requirements because we've already met those. And an example I can give you is the visioning process. There's been a great deal of that through the work of the Highlands Task Force and the work of the Highlands Council and the tax that you had in the early days of the Highlands Council. Did want to point out as well that Joy Farber is with us today from the Office of Smart Growth working for the State Planning Commission. Office of Smart Growth has shared the State Plan policy map results of the most recent cost acceptance process. That is a deliberative interagency document. This mapping has not yet been approved. So currently the 2001 State Plan is the legal State Plan, and the map is the policy. The 2001 map is the policy map for that State Plan. However, cross acceptance has been completed. So to facilitate our work for plan endorsement, Office of Smart Growth and State Planning Commission have shared that information with us. That really brings you up to date on where we are with this. We have been working with Office of Smart Growth and the State Planning Commission, and we'll ask to be put on their agenda, and we'll submit the plan when you adopt it. Right, the next issue before you today are draft plan conformance standards. These are standards that the staff has prepared as guidance for conformance. We will and do have prepared a stand-alone plan endorsement guidance document, but these are far more detailed, and they are not part of the regional master plan, but they will assist municipalities in achieving the standards that are in the regional master plan. Again, from the slides, they are guidance for municipalities, very detailed, but will assist municipalities get through the process and the counties. We expect these documents to constantly be refined during conformance, because the partnership that we will have with municipalities and counties will help us refine those documents so that over time they'll be even more beefed up and fleshed out. For example, if a town has an ordinance that we think should be listed as a model ordinance because it either meets or it exceeds our standards, we can do that. So they're always going to be flexible documents. And so with that in mind, it's important to say that they're not in the regional master plan, and that allows for that fluidity. Also, the consistency with the regional master plan is determined by the plan itself. These standards reflect what's in the plan. We previously gave you, at an earlier meeting, the steep slopes protection plan conformance standards. We did receive some public comments on that and comments from the council, so we've reissued that with some changes due to the comments received. And so this is going to be an ongoing process which we expect to continue after you have considered adoption of the plan. The standards that we to date have completed and given to you for that first look, all in draft form, are the following: critical habitat, land preservation and stewardship, carbon and rock area, lake management area, wellhead protection, agricultural resource area, right to farm, redevelopment, housing, community facilities, and sustainable economic development. And just so the council is aware, we did put these documents out for public review today as well. That's all on those standards. Summary of county plan performance. At a prior meeting, we gave you a summary of municipal plan conformance. So we've now given you the documents on county plan conformance. I want to be very clear that it's very much limited to those issues that the county has control over. So these are always where appropriate. So in many cases, you'll see a lot of analysis here, a lot of documents that are required, but they'll be very limited because of the purview of the counties. Planning analyses that we will expect through the plan performance process. Capacity constraints, natural resource protection, open space and farmland preservation, historic preservation, optimizing use of public infrastructure, transportation constraints and opportunities, fiscal impact and economic sustainability, county needs and obligations, and principles of sustainability and smart growth. They will develop a land use plan, update or overlay that is consistent with our regional master plan and our land use capability analysis.
Impact overlay that counties actually have. I know you keep referring to counties and performance. I went back and looked in the Act to see that, yeah, there is reference to counties in the Act. Knowing how land use takes place, I mean, we do have county planners, and they review applications and make recommendations to town, but they really have no real legal meaning. You know, the towns may, you know, accept their recommendations or ignore them.
We'll go back to Morris County, for example, and I'll tell them that they have no legal meaning in the county plan. And get a night off.
Well, I think towns usually often take their recommendations into account.
Well, there are some legal requirements that county plan boards can impose on municipalities and municipalities' plans. There are some. There's no question.
Anything on the county road?
Well, that's true.
Not others, but
it's nominal.
But I think in conjunction with your question about what value does and what authority would the county's performance have to the municipalities? That's really what you
really.
All right.
What we did is we looked at the county's authorities, and we see in every one of these that the county does have certain authorities, so that they would look at each of these issues and where their authority exists, that they will then, for example, on county roads, it's a very clear one, there are also county facilities where they have to take into consideration the kind of plan in the regional master plan.
Okay.
Okay.
I have a question. Is that because, like, a county park, for instance, like they're building a new county park, and it doesn't have to come under the municipal land use law, so it wouldn't go through the municipalities. So it would be things like that.
Yeah,
that would be a good example.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that, but that is true. So thank you.
When Judy Thornton on staff, who's our planner, who's been doing this work, she looked into this to see, to make sure that we were capturing wherever there may be connections and a nexus, to make sure that we were consistent, or that the counties would be consistent with the regional master plan.
Just to comment to Tracy, usually the county is doing something, even if they're exempt. They do a policy review with the towns anyhow, so the plans are discussed. So
it depends. I think we all have different experiences, and sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's not. And I think it could be an important loophole if it wasn't covered, so it's great that it is covered.
environmental infrastructure capacity analyses and RMP update analysis. Again, it's important to make sure we got our mapping correct, and if there are any issues that, where the county has jurisdiction, if they give us any factual corrections, any updates. An environmental resource inventory, we of course can help with that because we have a lot of information. Conservation practices, they should be looking at those as well. Water and wastewater analyses, a limiting factor analysis, just as we ask that of the municipalities, and a build-out analysis. Remembering as well that now under the new WMP rules that the counties are being asked to be the agents for wastewater management plans.
Excuse me, I don't know, one of the people on the phone, there's something else going on.
Okay, Janice.
If all of you could stop moving around your phones a bit, it would
have
some static.
I think someone might have a speaker phone.
Yeah, maybe.
That's an echo. We're making an echo.
Someone who looks a lot like Debbie is walking down the phone. Right. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. County master plan. County master plan components. Again, these are the components in the county master plan that should be examined for consistency. The policy goals and objectives, to measure them for consistency with the GPOs in the regional master plan. The land use plan. The relationship of the master plan to other plans, and we give you an example, so it's including, but not limited to, the SDRP, which is the State Development and Redevelopment Plan, more commonly known as the State Plan, and the Regional Master Plan, that's the Highlands Regional Master Plan. Environmental Resource Inventory, Conservation Plan, Wastewater Utilities Plan, Water Use and Conservation Plan, Transportation Circulation Plan, Open Space and Recreation Plan, Agriculture Retention Farmland Preservation Plan, applicable, County Facilities Plan, and Historic Preservation Plan. And then the supporting regulations that should be updated for consistency. Steep slopes, forest area, again, this is always as applicable and as appropriate within the purview of their authority. Steep slopes, forest areas, open water and riparian areas, groundwater recharge management, wetland protection, stormwater management, right to farm, critical habitat, carbonate rock areas, agricultural resources, lake management, low impact development, scenic resources, historic, cultural. County self-assessment. As a result of the environmental infrastructure analyses and the planning analyses, counties are to complete a self-assessment, identify areas requiring coordination with the Highlands Council and or affected municipalities and other agencies, and then do a county self-assessment report that lists and provides a schedule for all items necessary to achieve plan conformance. Again, just as we set forth a process to assist municipalities, the same process exists for counties if they need it in order to meet the timelines that are set forth in the Highlands Act. And that is that there's a basic plan conformance, and we gave you these two documents, which is plan conformance with conditions, and is a subset of plan conformance. And I'm going to emphasize this because Tim, if he's still listening, always makes sure that we do. There is only one plan conformance, and that is full conformance. However, to facilitate towns and counties to go through the process, the Act says that towns and counties with lands in the preservation area must submit their conforming applications within 15 months of regional master plan adoption. So in order to do that, we have the basic plan conformance, which are those mandatory first steps in order to achieve conformance with conditions. Also, and it's the next item on your agenda, the same grants that we spoke of today, those $15,000 initial assessment grants, we now have we're ready to give those same grants out to counties should they wish to do that. So the first cut, working with their professionals on the implications of the regional master plan for the counties.
Questions? Thank you.
return now to further discussion on the regional master plan. Where we are with this effort is that the council members have seen some version of every part of the regional master plan, and some, many of them many more times than once. We've had presentations about every policy area in the plan, again, many of them more than once, and had opportunities to discuss every policy area. All the sections of the plan, the policy sections, have been available to the public in various forms. As we move toward next Thursday's vote, the staff is planning to make available a full draft of the plan that we would be voting upon, and have that on the council's website by next Tuesday. And certainly have that available to council members as well. With that said, the next item is the further discussion, so there are no issues. Staff on the way up.
Okay. It's been quite a job to try to keep up with the changes that we've been going through in response to comments received and to council discussions at the various meetings. We are, as the chairman said, posting all of those items on the calendar section of the website. So for each meeting, all the items discussed then are then posted on the calendar. So that's one of the places to go. But remember that all these discussions are revisions to the November 2007 release. So in terms then of RMP discussion, the first items I'm going to talk about here are revisions that the staff wants to bring to your attention. Under historic, cultural and archaeological, we were directed by the council on June 12th and in order to meet the directives of the council, those policies and objectives are being modified to encourage the creation of an advisory historic preservation body rather than what was in the document, which was requiring the creation of a historic commission. So the language in the GPOs are being changed where necessary to be consistent with that directive. We just want to draw your attention to that.
Eileen, may I ask a question about that? What is the title of that body? Is it a committee? Is it what is it?
An advisory.
It's the historic. They can create a historic commission, or the planning board actually can act as the review authority for it. So there's flexibility under the municipal land use law to do it.
Okay. So it's non-specific.
It allows you to create a historic commission, or the planning board can act as.
The council will not create its own. Is that what you were saying?
That the council could create a historic commission if it wants to. Yes.
Which council?
The township.
Township.
Right. So they can just. Join a committee.
Yes, an historic commission.
Committee that doesn't have the powers of a commission.
You have the ability to create advisory committees. There's flexibility under the law.
We just wanted to make sure that if we followed your direction, that the GPOs mirrored that so that there was no inner conflict in the document. This is on drawing attention to that.
Okay.
Water conservation. As suggested by council members, the regional master plan should include a GPO, so a goal, policy, and objective, for agency coordination with the Jersey Department of Environmental Protection to promote water conservation, reuse, recycling, and other related measures, and mitigate for water distribution system losses, both in Highlands municipalities and in municipalities supplied with Highlands-derived water. Okay, so we're going to add that. Highlands Open Waters. In the Highlands Open Waters policy for Highlands redevelopment areas, which is Objective 1D4I, Step 5. So we're just talking about redevelopment areas. The language currently there allowing for council approval of buffer modifications for Highlands redevelopment areas was limited to Category 2 waters. We realized that was an error. It should also have included Category 1 waters. The modification would permit nothing less than the extent allowed under state regulation, which presently does limit the amount of buffer modification for all Category 1 waters. But the reason we think this is critical is because this change we're suggesting here is consistent with the waiver provision in the Highlands Act. So the Highlands Act has a waiver provision for redevelopment areas that go through a two-step process. You, the council, have to designate that it is a redevelopment site, and then the Department of Environmental Protection has to give the appropriate waivers under their authority for the minimal, to the minimal practical extent to allow for that redevelopment. We did not want, in our regional master plan, to limit what the waivers that are allowed for by the Highlands Act.
So this is not a change of policy, but a correction of a error.
We view it as a correction because we would never want to limit. I mean, this, you will get to decide if it's a redevelopment site, and the DEP will get to decide on what waivers, if any, they will allow for that redevelopment to occur. But the policy, the objective, as currently written, limits it further than the waiver under the Highlands Act does, and we want to correct that.
Question on that. Then, what would the process be? Because the state has its own process. If they're going to be reducing a 300-foot buffer of 750 feet, it's under certain conditions, they have a functional value, they have the whole thing they do in order to be able to reduce the 300-foot buffer. What would the process be? They would make their own decision and then we would make our own decision, or how would this work?
We've been working on this with NJDEP, and the process as set up currently, because we have some pilots before us, would be the Highlands Council meets with the Highlands Council and staff meet with the applicant to look at the proposal. So the proposal, for example, is an existing business in the preservation area that wants to avail of the opportunity for redevelopment under that 70% impervious surface opportunity. They come to the council, we do a whole analysis of the site, of the constraints, and the impervious surface on the site, and look at what the applicant is proposing and what would be the envelope in which they would be allowed to have that redevelopment and what would be the impact on the constraints. We bring that information to, we would actually have, we believe we should have a preliminary meeting with DEP, so that if DEP advises us for whatever reason that something isn't workable, that we don't leave the applicant too far down the path before we've had a conversation with DEP. But at this point, it's still a council decision. The council then decides, with all the information we furnish, the staff furnishes to the council, is this, does this meet your criteria? Is this a redevelopment designated site? If so, it then moves to the Department of Environmental Protection for the waivers necessary to allow for that to occur. So it's a two-step process, but you are first in the process.
Right. Well, I guess I appreciate the answer, but what if, let's take a situation where we felt that it should go down to 150 feet and DEP did not.
DEP granted the waiver, so they have authority on the provision of the granting of the waiver.
Because I was happy to see it was under Category 2, because I thought what we were doing is acknowledging that DEP is the one that has, I mean, the 300-foot buffers are established by DEP for C1 streams.
And they still maintain the authority here, but they do allow, that's what we say here, it would permit nothing less than the extent allowed under state regulation, which presently does limit the amount of buffer modification for Category 1 waters. So, but this would be a DEP decision, ultimately, because the waiver provision is the waiver is theirs to grant or not grant.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think it's really just a correction. I think it really is a change in our policy, because I think we could very well say, but for Category 1 streams, we want to keep it 300 feet and always keep it 300 feet. And I thought that's what we were saying, frankly. So, I mean, we don't have to say we have to go with what the waiver would allow under DEP's decision making.
I guess what I meant by correction was it wasn't, you're right, I mean, I agree with you, it wasn't a conscious decision and discussion by the council to get the language to be the way it was. It was so.
We didn't talk about Category 1 or Category 2, that's right. For sure, but right. We sure have talked about 20-foot buffers being the minimum that and there'll only be, you know, rare exceptions to that.
What is DEP's minimum? 150?
For Category 1 waters, there's a 150 is the least, and they have to do a functional value analysis.
And what's the minimum for Category 2?
There is, under the stream encroachment regs, actually, the new ones, I think it may be a 50-foot. I don't double check.
Yeah. What'd you say?
I think it's a 50-foot, but I have to double check it. They adopted new rules. I think that's correct.
It seems to me that there are likely to be extremely few redevelopment areas in the Highlands region as a whole, and that we shouldn't limit ourselves. Now, it may be we don't end up approving any in Category 1 waters, but we ought to leave ourselves the option to consider that. Because we're going to be looking at them on a site-by-site basis.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
As our DEP.
Right.
I guess it's kind of an odd process here, because now I'm thinking, all right, well, this should be included as an amendment if that's the language, but that's not the language. So are we going to vote on this being the new language? I mean, how should we handle this?
Good question.
Vote on when we vote on the plan.
Right. Well, I guess the question is what, I mean, I think what I would think this will be in the plan as the staff is recommending it. Because it's not really changing, it's not changing a policy position the council's already taken. And then, so if anyone wants to bring it up as an amendment to change it to restrict it to Category 2 waters, we could do that.
So we're treating it that it's part of the existing plan that we are reviewing.
Right.
It's even though it's really not in here,
right.
Right.
So it would be in the one we would see, we would have in front of us for next week.
So in order to change this, we have
right.
to consider an amendment and vote on it next
right.
week.
Right. That's what we do.
What we're allowing ourselves is the right to review the redevelopment area. If we don't review that in Category 1, then we're out of that picture completely, and the matter proceeds to be repaired.
As written, what this would do is if a redevelopment application came before the council, the applicant would be limited in the waivers they could apply for, because we're saying that they could not get a waiver for Category 1 waters for modification to the buffer. And that would be inconsistent with the Highlands Act itself, because it allowed for, it didn't limit that. And you do have the right, though, when you review it, to say no, because for whatever reason you think is appropriate. And then the DEP further, as Tracy pointed out, has that second step, because the waiver is actually theirs to grant. You designate the redevelopment site, the redevelopment area. They decide
upon
the
waiver. They need to go forward before us and DEP, not either or.
Yes. Agricultural cluster, a council member suggested that a minor revision, but wants to bring it to your attention, be included in the agricultural cluster GPOs in objective 3A5D, and that is to encourage that the original or new farmstead remain attached to the preserved land where feasible. Now, when it says preserved land, it is under the agricultural cluster GPOs. We're not referring to clusters for the purposes of environmental sensitive land protection. This is just for agricultural land. It's a minor revision, but we want to bring it to your attention. Okay, now I'm going to move on to the council's, the council has given to us in terms of the proposed revisions amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about a different revision.
Yeah.
Just a question. I had sent in a revision on the historic and scenic section, and I don't think it was made. It was an issue that had been brought up a long time ago. We had discussed about including where we referenced the Musconetcom on the Scenic River, that
yes.
we also referenced the Delaware. Lower Delaware, Robin Scenic River, middle and lower, actually, Delaware, Robin Scenic River. I had sent that text in. Okay.
I actually just sent that to staff and said, do it, because
we had already talked about
yes.
it a long time ago,
so
it just didn't
yeah.
get in here. So.
And I apologize, we'll double check that, but we did send it on, and we did say, we just, you know,
Okay, so it would go, I think, under Objective 4.5b, 4b5c, I believe.
Right.
So we'll just make sure no council member has a problem with that, so you don't all of a sudden see a change in that.
Okay. There are other, just, you know, always there are other minor changes that we make in the document, but we bring to you any that we believe are substantive. But, you know, if it's,
And it had been made before this came out. That's why I was afraid it dropped off the radar screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it'll be in the draft, the version we see next week.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is Tim. I'm sorry. I my phone died there for a while and I had to find another place. And I missed a lot of that conversation about the C1 buffers, but I caught the tail end of it. Not to reopen the discussion at all, but I don't think what I saw from the staff constitutes a revision. That conversation, as I recall, was very focused on only on C2 streams. So the idea that it was supposed to apply to C1, I don't think is a minor revision of something that got left out. And I would have a problem. I had to have a problem with both the policy part of it, but also with that process aspect of it. And I thought I heard, it's very hard for me to hear, but I thought I heard you were saying that the suggested revision language would go into the draft and would have to be amended, as opposed to an amendment having to go in to change what we voted on or considered at the last meeting.
Yeah, you did hear correctly, so.
Okay. Well, I don't think it's a revision. I think the conversation, and the debate was very much about C2 waters. The staff went to great lengths to, say this is only limited to C2 waters in the planning areas. And so this is a new policy recommendation coming from them to extend it to C1 waters.
We could take a straw vote and see which way people want this to be for the next week, and then we could consider it again next week. Let me try to phrase the question and see if it's clear to everyone. So the question is, should the Highland, the potential for Highland redevelopment areas be limited to Category 2 waters, or should it also include Category 1 waters?
Well, I think it's the buffer modifications. What we're addressing here is whether, when buffer modifications are being proposed for Highlands redevelopment areas, that they be limited, that the language be as it is in our current draft, which says it's limited to Category 2 waters.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Well, is that a clear question to people?
And what is the staff saying now?
The staff recommendation is that for redevelopment areas, that the buffer modifications not be limited to just Category 2 waters.
And the DEP allows that under the DEP rules.
It does, and I will absolutely own up. It was a staff correction, because the staff did not intend to limit the waiver that is allowed for in the Highlands Act.
So the staff recommendation is consistent with this modification?
The staff recommendation is that the Highlands buffer modifications not be limited to Category 2 waters.
Somebody point us in the plan to where the current language is.
Yes. In the version you have before you today, it is page 139. And it is at the top of the page, and it is number 5.
Can you read it, sir?
Would you like me to read it?
Yeah. And what word?
Where a proposed Highlands redevelopment area would not meet in full objectives 1D4B through 1D4H, but affects an undisturbed buffer area determined to not be necessary for the protection of the functional values for Highlands open water buffer for a Category 2 surface water, as determined through scientific analysis of site-specific conditions. Modification of the undisturbed buffer may be allowed to no less than the extent allowed in state or municipal regulation. However, the Council shall first determine that there is no alternative to the proposed reduction of the buffer and require a showing of no impact to the functional values of the buffer and provision of alternative approaches to enhancing or protecting the Highlands' open water and resources of the buffer area. Restoration or enhancement of buffer functional values shall be provided on site or within the same stream reach to achieve a net improvement of existing buffer functional values.
So the question would be whether to take out the phrase category 2 waters?
That is what the staff are recommending.
Right.
Or add the word category 1.
Okay, but let me, for the purpose of the sort of a phrase question, should this the buffer modification be limited to category 2 waters? Is option A. Option B is it should also include category 1 waters.
Oh, and John, if I might add, I think important language here when we go to the plan and we look at the full objective is that it's referring to an undisturbed buffer.
Yes.
Right. I think that's what we all have to be thinking about. I mean, I'm thinking of an area where an alternative is an area that's currently disturbed. We're looking at a redevelopment plan, and I think everybody would look at that a little differently than if we're talking about redevelopment that now is going to extend the disturbance of the buffer. I think that's a very different matter, and we ought to keep that in mind.
Well, that's good. So what would that mean if you had a proposed redevelopment area on a category 1 water with a disturbed buffer?
Doesn't apply to it. It just goes through the redevelopment process as set forth under the Highlands Act and that waiver provision and as set forth under your procedures for redevelopment.
And what authority would the council reserve for itself under those circumstances?
The exact same as it does, as we're suggesting here. The
council could say no.
The council can say no, yes. And the council can say yes, and the DEP can say no.
Let's say we're redeveloping an area that now has disturbances up to 50 feet, a 50-foot buffer. And so somebody comes along, and they're a good developer, and they'll say, I'm going to move that back to 100 feet, but I'm going to be putting more stuff within the 300 feet. You know what I mean? So that's why I think we have to allow some of this flexibility so that on an individual application, we'll be able to make those kinds of decisions because restoration is so important, I think. We've got to allow some flexibility in this. And I think if we don't, we're not going to get anything fixed.
Yeah, and the whole process is littered with checks and balances. This is, right, Tom? This is not a slam dunk under any circumstances. So I think that Member Letts's comment is very appropriate and consistent with it. So I think that the changing language would be consistent, but I have no problem.
The staff's major concern was that the waiver provision is allowed under the Act and that it should move forward as provided by the Act with those checks and balances
in there.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out that, the example that Nini gave is for a site that was disturbed down to 50 feet.
Yes.
We're talking about in number 5 here, and we're going to be discussing it later because it actually is one of the amendments that we're putting forward, but we're talking about under this section, undisturbed buffers for redevelopment. So it would be an example where you had a site and part of it is developed, but let's say there's a section of 300 foot that's not, and it's in good shape, and it provides very important environmental protection for that stream. What we're saying is we're going to allow that to be reduced here.
No, I don't think so. I think what we're saying is that the council then has to decide whether it's appropriate for redevelopment.
Yes, and I would just say that's sort of semantics. I mean, we are allowing it. The bottom line is we're moving the line.
I think there's a difference, with all due respect, between allowing it and making a decision about it.
I agree we have to make
a decision. We're allowing the council to make a site-specific decision.
Right. We're allowing it to be reduced to 150 feet from that 300 feet, that last little bit of riparian area that's left.
Given the near certainty that we're going to get to discuss this again in a week, let me ask for just a short vote of how many would like to keep to have the staff recommendation include
included in the draft plan.
Anybody on the phone? And how many would not?
None.
3, 4, 5. Okay, I would like to have a staff recommendation included, so that's the. So do include it, and we'll consider this again next week. That concludes that part, right? Can we move now?
That concludes that part.
The process, I know council members know this, I think council members know this, the process we're going to use to move forward with the plan is next week. I anticipate that we'll have a motion to approve the plan as presented to us, and assuming that's seconded, council members will be free to raise the proposed amendments to that plan. We'll get all the amendments that are on the table, so anyone who wants to propose any number of amendments can do so. Any of those that are seconded will be on the table. We'll then open the discussion for public comment, so the public will have a sense of both the plan as a whole and amendments that the council will be considering. We'll have public comment on that, and then we'll have council deliberation on each of the amendments in turn, followed by a vote on the motion as amended, that will be next week. So what we've discussed doing today is to give those members who know the amendments they are probably or likely going to bring up next week to present them so that we all have a chance to think about them. And what I'd like to try to limit this discussion to is not the question of whether these amendments are good or bad or whether you agree with them or disagree with them, but whether you understand them or whether we understand them. So to limit the discussion as much as possible to questions and clarity, so that if there are aspects of these amendments that maybe need wording changes to make their intent clearer or make them administratively more workable, that's something that can be dealt with over the next couple of days, and also just so that we all understand them so we have a better ability to think about them before we're presented with them more formally next week. So we have in our packets a list of amendments. I guess we should just do an order.
And I have them to put them up on the PowerPoint to aid the public in following the discussion.
And we'll just have the people who, people or person who put down the amendment explain it. And so most of them, I think all but one in this packet, come from Tracy and Tim. One comes from me. And then if there are other council members who have other amendments they are thinking about, even if they're not in writing, we can discuss those as well. So.
If amendment one is on the screen.
Okay. Amendment number one is to the water deficit program. So that's page 155 of the plan. And it the amendment is to delete section 2B3, which outlines the conditional water availability program, to conditionally provide water availability within a current deficit area with appropriate standards regarding its use. So this is something we've discussed at length. Tim and I both put forward this amendment in the last draft, but we feel strongly that it's very important that this amendment be considered by the council now. Is it clear what we're discussing?
It's clear to me. In fact, I'm a little dismayed because it's Tim who repeatedly says, are we going to go over this stuff again? We've already talked about it, and we've already concluded and made a decision about it. And now you've already indicated that we have talked about it. We have discussed it. We have discussed it in the last iteration of the draft plan. And now it's coming back again. How many times must we review the same territory?
I think this is the time to bring up issues, even if we have visited them before, because we're at the point where we are have high potential. We're going to consider adopting a regional master plan. And
we have been doing, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, we have been doing that all along.
Right.
Everything in the plan is are items that we have discussed and we have made decisions about as we've gone forward. This is one of them, and so have many of these others that we're just going to be talking about now. It seems to me, frankly, a great waste of the council's time.
I don't agree, and I object to that, because, first of all, I don't think you should be characterizing what Tim says. I don't ever remember Tim saying, we're talking about things too much. I mean, one of the very important functions of this council is to debate the weighty issues that we have to debate and decide on. And if we don't do that, then we're not carrying out our own individual responsibilities. This issue is a key issue, and how the council members are going to vote on this plan, some council members' votes are going to hinge on this very amendment. So I think that for you to throw it aside as being already dealt with or talked about too much is denigrating the importance of whether or not we should be allowing additional water use, new and expanded water use in current deficit areas. It's a fundamental issue regarding this plan.
Question on a procedural issue. We exist under Robert's rules, is that what we're using?
As a guidance.
The fact of the matter is that if an amendment has been voted on and discarded, then only a member, then only a person who voted in the majority should be bringing that forward. It's pretty clear. I mean, that's the intent of having an orderly meeting. So what Jack says is correct. I don't know that to be the case because I probably wasn't here for that. And I'm not certainly saying that we should cut debate off, but as a procedural matter, we should be looking at not revisiting things unless someone in the majority of the vote wishes to bring that matter back before the council. Otherwise, you're right. You just continue to go through that every time somebody brings up a motion.
I think many of these amendments, proposed amendments, will revisit issues we've discussed before. But I think, as Tracy says, I think they're important issues, and they've been discussed before in the context of what would be at the motion or what would be in the various drafts.
We didn't take a vote on it. That's
we did not take a vote. And to the extent we're guided by Robert's rules, in any case, I think it's appropriate that council members who have serious concerns, policy concerns about the draft, be able to bring up those concerns, and if the majority agrees, then we'll make changes to the plan, and if they don't, we won't.
As a procedural matter, the council issued a resolution back to release the draft master plan in November of 2007. The purpose of the comment period is to provide additional comments, and to the extent that the public weighed in on new issues, the council is free to re-examine the plan given those comments.
The next meeting, when we take a vote, it's final. That one we're going to go through item by item. We're going to vote on these. And if something is voted down, the only way it can be reintroduced will be through a majority voting member reintroducing it. And when we take our actions at the next meeting, they are going to be final actions.
In terms of releasing
draft
plan, now the following meeting, we open up the new business, it's a whole new clean board again, but in terms of taking action to release the final plan.
Correct, yes.
We're going to hit them one at a time, and when it's done, it's done.
Correct. Correct. Okay. So, getting back to this First Amendment, I think you finished your introduction of it, but does anyone have any questions? Okay, let's go to the second one.
Okay, the second one, there's two parts to this, and this is just really for thought. If the council is not, if any council member is not in support of Amendment 1, there's some alternatives here. And the first one is under Objective 2B8B1, which is on page 157 of our plan. And that statement in the plan is, each project shall achieve mitigation ranging from 125 to 200% based on the severity of the current deficit and the amount of consumptive or depletive water use proposed. And for large consumptive and depletive water uses or high current deficits, will require achievement of the mitigation prior to the initiating water use. Now, if you remember, this has been changed, wordsmithed somewhat, and some of the policy changes have been worked into this section based on input from the public and council members since the draft was put out last fall. But we are suggesting that this statement be added. Water use and conservation plans as described in Objective 2B8C, which is also on page 157, shall resolve the current deficit in the subwatershed prior to approval for new water uses in the subwatersheds with high deficits. And if your
you know, would like to know what high deficits mean. We do use the word severe in other places that the RMP does. I would suggest that we look at the paper water deficit policy options that we received a while back. On page 2 of that paper, there was a discussion of, there was a table and then a discussion of the various levels of deficit that various HUC 14s have. And we saw that of the 114 HUC 14s that are in deficit, the worst of them, which you could consider to be the top four, as an example, that's what I would put forward, which would be 50 of these HUC 14s, were ranging between 1 million and 0.25 million gallons per day deficit. I would call those the worst. We can discuss further at some point if council members would like to define worst as perhaps 500,000 to 1 million, which would reduce the number of proteins that we'd be addressing. But this is an alternative and something to consider if Amendment 1 does not pass. I suggest that we vote on Amendment 1 first next week and then consider this as an alternative. I think what it does is it at least addresses the highest or the most severe water deficit watersheds.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question of Scarruccio? Are you saying that, you know, let's say that somebody wants to just build a couple of houses in an area that has a deficit, but before that anything can happen, the entire deficit in the entire sub-watershed has to be resolved?
Yes.
So the watershed could extend over miles?
Yes.
So who's going to do this? And it'll cross.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead.
No. Yeah. I think we have to think this. Yeah. It'll cross municipal boundaries. It can cross county boundaries. How is this going to possibly ever happen?
Well, there is quite a bit of discussion in our plan about how to address water deficit areas. And we have put together, put together a process of putting these water use and conservation plans in place. So if we don't use water from these worst areas, and we put into place our water use and conservation plans in conforming municipalities, then if we believe in this mitigation, we're going to be addressing that and moving forward. It just means we're not going to allow the worst ones to get worse before it gets better. We're giving the mitigation plans, the conservation and water use efficiency plans, an opportunity to work and resolve that deficit before we start adding new uses to those most severe deficit areas.
Well, question for just a clarification. Those properties that are exempt from the Act, meaning existing lots, et cetera, would not be affected by this. Right?
That is correct.
That's a point of clarification. Mm-hmm.
However, if we leave the plan the way that it is, it seems to me that there is some hope that we could improve the situation somewhat. You know, if we allow some building, but they have to, we'll at least get 25% improvement, correct?
Theoretically.
The way that this is now, we're never going to get any improvement, I don't think.
We're going to do this next week is debate whether this makes, with the, you know, people agree with the change or not that proposed, but you understand the change that Tracy's proposing, I believe.
I think I get it.
So the theory is, Mr. Chairman, we should just allow Tracy to run through these amendments, don't say anything, and then we'll debate it next week.
No. I'm saying to make sure we understand. I mean,
I think some of them are, you know, are a little obtuse. You need to understand what exactly these mean because. You have to look back and see what objectives it is being referred to. So I don't want people to be voting. And I think it's good to do this because it would be bad if a council member were to vote for or against because they didn't, you know, understand what we were trying to say. So.
And I agree that Mimi's example is a clarification or an attempt at clarification. So I don't object to her.
Allow me a question of clarification then. So within your proposal then, an MUA has a well that's exporting water to another water system, we could take action then to shut off that well to restore the
to as a form of mitigation, right?
Well, there's in the program we talk about, you know, what, why are these areas in deficit? And in the plan, it's discussed. A lot of it has to do with infrastructure. It has to do with, you know, where pipes go, and there may need to be institutional addressing of these issues. But we also believe in the water use and efficiency program that we're putting forward and requiring conforming municipalities to address. So it really depends on what the site-specific situation is. I don't think it's going to be one or the other in a particular project instance. This just says, for the ones that are the very worst, let's not make it worse. Let's wait until those are brought into conformance, out of deficit, based on our water use and efficiency plans and any other institutional actions that may be taken.
So do we have authority to require Jersey City to implement water conservation measures, for instance, Councilor?
No, our authority is limited to our jurisdiction. We do have, the Highlands Act does provide for agency coordination where we work with DEP to address issues. DEP does regulate those entities.
So the HUCs that are around, for instance, Parsippany Reservoir, Wooten Reservoir, Rockaway River that supply Jersey City with their water, I don't know if they're deficit or not, but let's presume for discussion that they're deficit. So the entire burden of restoring those HUC-14s would fall on the local residents and not on Jersey City, where all the water is getting exported to.
Well, I think we're mixing apples and oranges.
I don't know what we're doing.
Because we should be having conservation programs throughout New Jersey, absolutely. But we're talking about the source, where the source of the water is. And those areas are in deficit because there's too much water going out of those HUC-14s, then it's over-allocated.
Right. Well, so it's flowing from the Rockaway River into the Booten Reservoir, and a certain percentage of it's getting pumped out to Jersey City for everything they're using their water for. The rest is allowed to flow downstream and continue on, which I think goes into the Passaic eventually. But the bottom line is, a lot of the deficit is caused because the water is being exported. If the water never left the Rockaway River, there'd be a lot more water in those HUC-14s.
Yeah, but the bottom line is we're providing water to half the people of New Jersey from these source watersheds.
And the entire burden, as you propose, falls on the people in the Highlands region to preserve water for everybody who's
No, it's just that those people in Jersey City aren't drinking the water from under their feet. Those people in Jersey City are dependent on all of us up here in the Highlands to take good care of the watersheds and make sure that they recharge and make sure that we're not overtaxing our sub-watersheds. At any rate, I think, yes, there are institutional issues, and we have discussed them, and they're in the plan when we talk about them.
Still,
Kurt brings up an interesting point. Think about it a little differently. Who are the individuals that are going to be looking for these waivers and construction? These are going to be non-exempt structure for folks that want to develop these deficit watersheds. And perhaps the only path for mitigation is to negotiate with Jersey City, in your example, to allow for less water to be removed. And what effect you may have is you may be in a position as a developer, as a builder, however, to negotiate with the water user to reclaim some of that water for the HUC-14. I don't know whether I'm in support of the amendment or not, but it's an interesting question in terms of how you would look at putting water back into a deficit watershed. Now, I don't know if it's possible, but it certainly is one way to force their hand.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I would just say that we should be doing that anyway, and I think we are going to be doing that anyway, and I wouldn't want to hang my hat on having a developer do it for us. These are issues that we're going to have to grapple with.
But those are the people that have been coming before to try and mitigate, and so just an interesting question.
Let me comment on that issue, Mr. Cogger. You know, having been in a position of trying to negotiate with Jersey City over water coming from that reservoir, I can tell you it takes years and years. It's an incredibly difficult process, and you will never win.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I think it's ironic that Kurt Austin is being accused of mixing apples and oranges.
He's the grown orange.
A wall.
All right. I think it's time to...
The question is, notwithstanding, even if this provision were enacted, we're not enacted, would not the council have the authority not to permit further depletion?
Yes, because the applicant and the town would have to come before the council and do their mitigation plan and prove their mitigation plan before you would allow it to go ahead.
So the council, again, holds the ultimate authority on this issue?
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
How do they prove mitigation?
And what we did is in the technical report we showed some examples. But now, first of all, the policy divides the areas of deficit into two parts. So some are required to do the mitigation in advance. Those that are in the highest deficit or looking for the most water are required, and it's part of that policy paper that Tracy referred to. They're required to do the mitigation in advance. So that's proof because they've done it. Those other projects that are smaller or in areas that are maybe marginally, because there are many that are only marginally in deficit, will have to prove to you that they can do that mitigation. So they'll have to offer those proofs to you. And the example we gave you was Randolph Township, who gave us their report on the mitigation that they had done within Randolph, showing what they had sort of recaptured in the system through leaks, fixing leaks, etc. And they also used low-impact development or fixtures and fittings. And they showed what they regained into the system. And that was, we offered that as proof to the council that these kind of things can occur and should occur. And if that's what we're all about here, is trying to do a better job and recapture water so that you can actually better use what you do have.
Ask Tracy a question to clarify. I think it might help everybody here. You've referred several times to this relates to existing programs we already have for conservation. I think some of this sounds like a totally new, brave new world idea, and I think you're trying to point out to us we've already provisions for this. Could you elaborate on that so you can help us understand that this, and I think it's alternate amendment that more relates to that point. I'd like to understand how that.
The next alternate, or you mean?
Yeah, your alternate amendment.
Right.
Well, I think that rather than your primary amendment relates to my question.
Well, the RMP, requires that that when a town is going through a conformance process, that they put together, I think it was called a water management plan. I think now it's called a water use and conservation plan. And those plans are required whether or not you're in an existing constrained area, a current deficit area, or anything. It's for all conforming municipalities. And they're supposed to address the situation that we all face, which is that we have a limited amount of water. And to make sure that when we use it in the way that's most efficient, that recharges as much as possible. When we develop, for instance, to go to the full extent or beyond what the stormwater requirements are, which is to recharge the water that would end up the stormwater runoff afterwards through your BMPs, to reuse water that could be reused, for instance, for a golf course instead of using fresh water from a well or from a stream, to reuse reclaimed water from a treatment process. I mean, there's many provisions that we have worked out over the last few years of how these water use efficiency programs and this conservation program would work for municipalities. But the goal is, and I think we believe in this. We know that infiltration works when you put your prevent your stormwater from running off and put it back into the ground. We know that using fresh water for some aesthetic purposes is wasteful. And other places in the country of the world wouldn't dream of doing that that are more water short than we're blessed with in this area. So I think that, we put a tremendous amount of thought into those plans, and we believe they're going to work. So let's let them work, is what we're saying in these amendments, before we start using more water from the areas that are in deficit.
So the alternative, so if Amendment 1 fails,
right,
then you would introduce Part 1 and Part 2 of Alternate Amendment 1?
Yes.
Correct? Okay.
But again, these methods, we only have the authority to implement these conservation measures in the Highlands region. Preservation area, absolute, correct me if I'm wrong. Planning area, if they opt in and there's conformance. And we have absolutely no authority in all the areas that use Highlands water.
A point that many of us have criticized.
Right.
Going back many years.
I think if everyone's comfortable with this, we could move on to the Second Amendment.
The second part of this amendment, not so fast.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Policy 2B3, general area of the water deficit program. And that statement, as it reads under objectives 2B3A, B, and 2B9B, is to conditionally provide water availability within a current deficit area with appropriate standards regarding use. We would suggest the second part of this alternate amendment one would be that we would add an existing constrained area. That is, areas, as you know, in the, according to objective 2B2E, existing constrained areas are those sub-watersheds that drain to areas that are currently in deficit. So though these areas are not yet constrained, but if consumptive uses are allowed to grow from the areas downstream that are in current deficit, then the area, and at the same time, the areas that are existing constrained areas draining to them continue unabated, then we're going to be making our problems worse. In other words, it will be another layer of making things get worse before they get better. The existing constrained areas, we call them out, they're in the plan, we know where they are, and we're not paying attention to them in terms of limiting water use. We're only looking at the current deficit area. So what we're saying is let's add those areas in and put the same requirements for the mitigation, the 125% mitigation, onto those areas. Is that clear?
One question. Absent that language that you're proposing, would the council still have the ability to allow this provision on a functional value basis? When the application came before the council, an application came before the council.
I don't know exactly what you mean.
Yeah,
no?
No, I don't know.
You mean an application in the constrained area?
I don't think unless we have as an objective that we're going to require 125% mitigation for existing constrained areas that we could require that. But I just question.
Could we not require that rather than, if we don't have this language in, could we not require it when an application came before us that was exhibiting these characteristics?
Not as currently written. But what you're saying is we would allow an application to come before us and we would apply the 125% mitigation in existing constrained areas just as we are in the other areas. It's not currently in the plan.
Yes.
Because those areas are not actually in deficit.
Right, because of the process that Tracy has described here, that it would become constrained. I mean, it is constrained, but it would become polluted, so to speak.
It could go into deficit, is what.
So, under that scenario, if we had an application for the council, could the council say, "Well, you know, this is a very tricky situation, and we'd like to ask you to mitigate it"?
Not as currently written.
Okay.
No.
How many constrained areas are there? What percent?
I don't know the percent.
The staff would have to figure
that
out. Large
percentage of these? Well, you have 114 out of 183 in deficit. They are mapped. And
they're mapped.
You're talking about areas upstream of those that are constrained.
So 114 out of 183 are in deficit.
Correct. In planning and preservation area.
Right. And we don't know what percentage of the other ones would be constrained.
Well, the percentage of constrained. No, we don't have that. Thank you.
Could be a lot. We could have that next week.
Yes. I don't see Jim.
Right. In other words, you're saying it's got to be 125% for the whole pilot.
Well, okay. Jim says offhand he doesn't know. We will look into it.
Yeah,
okay. I don't want to commit to something.
Yeah. Well, this is exactly why. I mean, one of the reasons why we're discussing these now, so we can have that information in front of us next week.
Okay. Amendment two. This relates to Highlands Forest Resources. It's on page 135 of the plan, and it's policy 1B under policy 1B8. It's called objective 1C2D. We've discussed this pretty recently. It's the Section reads, support incentives and funding opportunities and provide criteria for demonstrating and maintaining intrinsic forest values and societal benefits through various means. What we are suggesting is that the sentence be completed this way. Through various means, including but not limited to the use of stewardship benefit credits in lieu of cash receipts under the Woodland Management Program of the Farmland Assessment Program. I'd just like to point out that we're not saying, and we don't use the language of requiring that we put forward an amendment of the Act, the Farmland Assessment Act. We're simply talking about exploring and looking into programs that will allow credits in lieu of cash payments. And I can elaborate if you want me to, but I think yes. Everyone knows what that is.
I hate to be the only one. I'd like to hear from the farm community representative on the Highlands Council.
Well, the only thing I'd say is I think if you look at probably the most difficult applications that assessors review right now are these small woodlots for legitimacy. And when they, and why are they having the most difficulty? Because they're the ones probably most subject to abuse. So if we create, my gut is, if we create another method for them to qualify on these small woodlots without demonstrating traditional forestry stewardship practices, and they're not even going to be required to generate income, I think it's going to make the assessors that much more angry, perhaps, or skeptical, and I think it's going to create a bigger public relations snafu for the Farmland Assessment Act, because they are the ones that are always under scrutiny. But we've also heard from professional foresters that have said that they can demonstrate how they can successfully do management programs with very limited harvesting and with forest regeneration on these small woodlots successfully.
And all this does is, and I think that's true, and I think all this does is say that we would support the concept and try to make work the use of credits instead of cash. Because what happens is people who have these small lots or large lots, these woodland assessments, go in and cut down a whole bunch of trees because they have to show that they've earned $500 for their 5 acres and then so many dollars for every acre above that. And they're afraid not to cut it because they don't want to lose their farm, their woodland assessment.
But in all fairness, so I think if you look at these small woodlots, you look at the management plans that they're required by law to have on them, it does not take a tremendous amount of harvesting to qualify.
What quart of wood go for a year?
300 now. So two
so
quarts
you're
of wood a year.
Two quarts of wood.
A lot of them are just trees that need to be thinned out anyway. And you're allowed to do it over, you get inspections every three years by the state forester. It's not an onerous process. And you have a lot of foresters that argue that this thinning out should be happening, that it promotes the regeneration of better native species. If you ask me my opinion, Mr. Schreier, I'm sharing it.
No, thank you. And, but in any case, this would not mandate credits in lieu of cash.
No, it just allows that we use that concept, and we try to figure out a way that we can support credits instead of cash.
Could somebody explain this credits? I mean, what are these credits? What are they for? Who gives them out, and what can they do with them?
Well, as Kurt mentioned, I mean, we don't have all the answers to this. That's what it's for. But as Kurt mentioned, there's a program, and you have the inspectors that go out at least every 3 years. They look at your woodland assessed property to make sure that you're meeting the requirements of the Woodland Management Program and the Farmland Assessment Act. I have this on my own property, and I can tell you that the inspectors come out, and I don't agree. I think it is an onerous process. If you haven't cut down enough trees, and they don't count, okay, how many cords of wood. They want to see your cash receipts, but they also want to see the numbers of trees laying on the ground. And I'm not exaggerating. If you don't have enough trees cut down, then you get a letter that you're going to lose your farmland assessment. And this goes on across the state. And I think that what happens is in order for the the foresters who run these, you know, who do these, put these, together these plans for the property owner to not be worried. They overdo. I see it happening throughout my township.
I just want to know what this credit means.
Well, that's why I was wondering, why would this, you're saying this would not require amending the Farmland Assessment Act to have...
Well, we heard from one of the foresters that he felt that this could be done. So if this can be done, and you don't have to show cash, let's explore it with the... I don't know how we would work all the details of this out. Right now, we're precluded from doing it. Right now, we're not saying that we are going to move forward with this effort to try to allow credits. And when I say credits, I mean there would be a program that would be worked out. There's actually been ones put together and put forward as amendments to the Farmland Assessment Act. We don't have to go that route. What I'm saying, this is, we could look at some of those programs, pull together how the credits would be counted, but show that you are doing forest stewardship programs that equal the value of trees being cut and sold.
Why wouldn't the word incentives in the current policy provide us the flexibility to explore this without changing it?
Well, I think specifically because we talked about this and it was not agreed to put the words credits in here.
Okay.
So I think the intent of the council is not to move towards that.
Okay.
And all this
is
just, all this is saying is we would like to consider this for
future. Can we keep one conversation?
We're still trying to
take
back credits.
Okay. Yes.
Stewardship benefit credits. Maybe it's underlined. Stewardship benefit credit.
What is it?
Right.
Credit?
But what is it?
Credit?
What
is it?
It's the value of qualified for the farmland assessment. Rather than showing cash receipts, you would get some credit for what you were doing or not doing, and it would qualify you for farmland assessment.
Exactly. In lieu of cash.
Okay, based on certain performance standards.
Whatever
you
would think. And right. Those have been developed. I mean, there's a whole movement amongst foresters for this. And there is a forest stewardship program, you're just not allowed to use that in lieu of cash payments now.
So if you demonstrate a good practice based on what this forester finds, you get a credit and then you don't have to cut down a tree and sell a cord of wood.
Exactly. And often the trees are cut down just because you have to cut down a certain number of trees, not because it's a bad tree that needs to be removed or it's a weedy tree or it's diseased. It's just to meet the requirements of what that inspector wants to see laying
over. Yeah, Bill just asked if we have the authority to do this, and I think the answer, I think what the amendment's proposing is that we explore.
We explore.
Encourage.
Explore.
I
that
agree.
Was my question. Right. I think that's all
one
other
point that I would raise, though, is one has to beg the question. If what we're proposing is a program to not harvest trees, is it really farming anymore? And I think what you're really suggesting is, you know, farming of trees is farming of trees. You harvest some, you replenish, and you let them grow, and you harvest them again. And if we're going to have a situation where we think it's beneficial to our mission to not have trees harvested from a forest, my opinion, we shouldn't be looking at ways for it to qualify for farmland assessment. It should be on its own little world as, you know, a forestry preservation program, and if there's a special tax rate that goes with that, fine. But I think that you're creating something that doesn't fit with farmland preservation.
Well, because it's something being produced.
Right. That's right. It's not
production.
I agree with you.
Production for it to qualify.
But I see this is how it begins, to develop that new program that you talked about. If we don't put that in there, anything the council would pursue.
And also, I would point out that there are Department of Agriculture programs which allow, like the WIP program and various other programs, that do allow farmers to use preservation approaches, habitat protection approaches, and they don't lose their farmland assessment for that, do they?
But I don't think that we're looking solely on tracks that are just wooded.
No, but I'm saying,
you know,
in terms of this,
farm-wide conservation plan where the woodland is appertaining to the rest of the cropland, and that's how the whole system works together. That applicant's not relying on strictly the income from the forested land. In fact, your best scenario for you is a farm that has sufficient cropland, more than 50%, so that they don't have to have a woodlot management plan. And then the forest can be untouched forever.
Yep, the fact is there's many, many people that just have woodlots. And especially in New Jersey, a lot of the old farms have woodlots up on the mountain, and so there's a lot of woodlots sitting around without any cropland attached to them. And those are the ones that are often the core forest areas, and the ones the most valuable.
Okay. Other questions?
Third Amendment, Highlands Open Waters and Riparian Area.
Before you go to the project, Tracy, just wanted to, staff have provided with me with an answer to your question, so you're not getting it next week. There are 114 out of 183 huts, 114 are in deficit, a further 31 are existing constrained. So it's not a percentage, but that's the number of huts. So 114 are in deficit, a further 31 are existing constrained.
How many are there total?
183. That's 144 in total.
Thank you.
Okay. Since we're still back on amendment
one. No, sorry. We're not back on
amendment three.
Amendment three. We can come back to it after.
Highlands Open Waters and Riparian Areas. Now, when... Is it up?
No, sorry.
No, that's okay. I noticed there was a deletion that shouldn't have been in this, and I'm going to verbally speak it, add it in so you'll know. It's policy 1D4, objective 1D4I, delete, it should say delete 4 and 5, and I'll discuss why, because then later in my text, which is not up there, but which is in my notes to the council members, talk about the redevelopment areas. So the concept is in order for, so if you turn to page 139, if you remember, we have discussed this recently as last meeting. What this allows for is the reduction of the buffer through a planning process and down to 150 feet for disturbed areas. And this amendment says is that the 300-foot stream buffer should be kept in place. There's been a lot of analysis that led us to establish, and the state to establish also for this program, the 300-foot buffer. And then number five is the redevelopment paragraph we were discussing earlier. There is a modification to this, which is different than what we had discussed in the past. I want to point that out, and I noticed it when putting together the amendment. But that paragraph, also on page 139, deals with Highlands redevelopment areas. And since we just discussed it, it's fresh in everybody's mind. But it addresses the modification of undisturbed buffer areas associated with a redevelopment project. And we are also suggesting that paragraph be deleted. And because redevelopment areas, in our opinion, can handle having 300-foot buffers, and particularly in where these are probably going to go, which is in developed areas, it's very important to provide the natural attenuation of pollutants from the developed area through the buffers that are left. So in our view, sort of turn the other way around to say that those few that we do have, we should keep in place because they're going to be the best BMPs we could ever come up with. And they're going to provide quality of life and other multiple benefits to the people who live in that developed area. I would like to point out that under that number 5.2, number 5, it says, it used to say a minimum of 150 feet in our last iteration. And this number 5 has changed from the last iteration. And says, and perhaps it changed at the last meeting, but I was on the call. I didn't hear that discussed when it went from 150 feet down to the state minimum for redevelopment.
We moved the 150 feet was meant to have been in number 4, and that's what we discussed at the last meeting. So we moved, it wasn't in number 4, which is where it was meant to be.
Okay,
so that's what happened, Tracy.
I was surprised that it wasn't in, the 150 wasn't in number 5. I think it should be. But now, just to make very clear what number 5 says, and we did just discuss this, is that you can develop undeveloped areas associated with redevelopment projects down to the state minimum, which is 50 feet. And that's not right. Why doesn't a developed area deserve as much protection to its part of the stream as, you know, areas that are not undergoing redevelopment? And also, I would argue that the water quality of the stream is directly impacted by this, and we can't ignore the fact that natural buffer is already contributing
to an existing level of high of water quality, and any change to that buffer is going to impact that water quality for those there and downstream. Sorry, I got a little bit into the debate, but.
You said in passing there, and I'm not sure that's what you meant, that redevelopment areas can handle a 300-foot buffer.
What I mean is, when you're redeveloping, you can build a 300-foot buffer into that and preserve that 300-foot buffer in that redevelopment project. It's not impossible. It can be done. And I think we have to look at the site-specific situations. But we have parks in towns. And we have many areas in towns where there's a 300-foot buffer. And those areas are very important. And why should we just assume that in order to redevelop an area, that we need to reduce that buffer? I don't think we do. And I think that, as a matter of fact, we should not. And we should say, we're going to keep that 300-foot buffer where we've got them.
But I would assume, would you assume that there will be some potential redevelopment areas that would not be redevelopable if there was a 300-foot buffer?
That may be.
Okay, that's all I meant. So, okay.
And to your point, is it not possible to do a redevelopment with a 150-foot buffer and protect the stream?
Not as well as that 300-foot buffer, I would answer.
Sorry?
Right. They said not as well as the 300-foot buffer. Okay.
Could I just ask a clarification about, I understand the substance of what you're saying. I'm having trouble following along. Page 138 to 139, what you're actually asking to delete.
Four. Yeah. I know. That's what I said verbally. It should have said N5. I'm sorry about that.
So you want to delete these two all together,
right?
Okay. Amendment 4.
Okay. Amendment 4 is also under Highlands, Open Waters, and Riparian Areas. It would be a statement that would be added under Policy 1D4, the section we're still talking about here. And it applies to several objectives, 1D4, left the 4 out, B, D, E, F, and I. And this is assuming that all those sections stay in, the council does not take those out, but if I does come out, it would still apply to the others. And that is this statement. For purposes of this section, or these sections, but it could be repeated in each of these sections, historical or current agricultural land uses shall not be considered, and I'd like to insert improvements, development, land disturbances, and land uses. Should have put improvements, because when you look at the actual language in 1D4D, D, and D, it uses the word land improvements. So drop that out when I was writing this out. Is that clear?
I have a question. What do you mean by historical?
In the past. Like if you've been out there and you've been farming that area.
How about a mill?
It's not, no, I'm talking about farming, not structures.
Not structure, just farming.
I'm talking about agricultural use, land use. So structures are dealt with here specifically in other sections, they're called out.
Are ag structures different than any other structure, Mr. Counselor?
For the purposes of the plan, I think the intention is that this is just limited to agricultural use, not agricultural development.
Right. Agricultural land use. That's the word that we used.
So to be clear, it's non-structural agricultural land.
That's right. If you're farming an area, it's not permanently destroyed. So it doesn't really fit in with the definition of a disturbed area. And therefore, it's been disturbed, so we should reduce the buffer in that area. It can be restored, and we know that. And farmers restore buffers all the time. And there's a whole program to, targeted at that.
So what is the ultimate impact here? You're after something.
Clarification. I brought it up before. What do you mean by disturbance?
What's the end goal? It's not just to clarify.
Well, what it says. No, well, the
what
end goal.
What you're saying is what you mean, then, correct me if I'm wrong, is that your goal is to eliminate the ag production in that. You're basically making it a non-conforming use, a prior existing non-conforming use. So basically you're saying that you may have fruit trees there right now within the 300-foot buffer, but we don't want those fruit trees there.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. There's in these various objectives, and let's take one as an example. Let's take...
What page does this
This is on page 137.
And let's use 1D4E. In the protection and conservation zones of the planning area, proposed disturbances of highland open waters shall only occur in previously disturbed areas, unless a waiver, and then it goes on. In other words, if you're farming an area, that's not previously disturbed, because what we're talking about is it's already had its values diminished to a point where, you know, you might as well go ahead and put a house there. And that's not what agriculture does. The areas that are under active agricultural cultivation can be easily restored. It's not a permanent intrusion on the landscape. So, and the same thing for the next one. Objective 1D4F, in the existing community zone or planning area, proposed disturbances of highlands, open water buffers shall only occur in previously disturbed areas, unless you get a waiver. This would say that you're not counting agriculture as a previously disturbed area. What we're talking about there, and I think the intent of this whole thing, is where there's a parking lot. We say it many times. You know, we have a building or a parking lot or a road that goes within 50 feet. That's not a farm field. That's macadam.
Let's use
very different.
Kurt's farm, Kurt's property is an example. Your crop fields, layout, they're not previously disturbed for the purposes of this.
That's right.
But your parking lot, your gravel area where you have all your
forest
gardens, garden supplies and things, that's disturbed.
Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to add non-structural accuracy to your...
non-structural? Sure. To make it clearer?
Make
I mean,
lot,
I'll discuss this
make it
with
a lot
Tim.
Clearer than
I'll talk about it with Tim, but I think that's within what we were getting at here. Is that clear to everybody? Do you want to go on to the next one?
Yes.
And then there's five.
Just quickly, what impact does this definition have on the existing policy, or is there none?
No, that I think there's a clear intended impact. Is that you're treating agricultural non-structural uses differently, and therefore the policies will shift when those activities take place.
Which policies?
The Highlands Open Water buffer policies.
Okay.
Everybody got this?
No.
Well,
obviously.
Could these policies apply to previously disturbed areas?
Right.
Under Tracy's suggestion, these non-structural ag uses would not be considered previously disturbed.
Right.
Which then means what?
Then you're not able to, I mean, under these, if you just read the paragraphs and exclude it, then you'll know that it doesn't mean that you can disturb it for further development.
Right. And so here's my concern. Most farmsteads are located along streams because historically, streams were the source of water. They were a source of water for not only the house, but for livestock and everything else. So when you logically extend a farmstead, if you're putting up an addition to a barn or a new machinery shed or some other packing house structure, whatever, you want to keep it compact where you have all of your existing buildings already, because that's where your infrastructure is, where your septic is, where electric is, where the well is. So what happens when you want to add on the 30 by 30 building, but you're within the 300-foot buffer of the stream that your 200-year-old farmstead is built next to? We want to minimize it's a preserved farm, so we want to minimize the intrusion onto prime soils and croplands. So do we, and maybe you're within the whole campus, so to speak, is within 200 feet. So we can skip 100 feet and then just stick this 30 by 30 building out in the middle of the field to honor the 300-foot buffer. Or are we going to try to keep the hamlet and keep it compact?
I think if I could try to jump in here, I think the issue is when you're doing agricultural use activities, let's say disturbance, doing farm activities along a 300-foot buffer, that if you were to develop that property, it's now considered disturbed under the existing policy. If you were to develop that purpose for non-agricultural development, you wanted to put a strip mall in that property. What Tracy's point is getting to is that the agricultural use, the non-structural use, isn't considered disturbance because that can revert back to natural conditions. but so that you wouldn't allow a strip mall to build, put aside ag development because that's going to be a separate activity, but you wouldn't allow a strip mall to be built in that farm field.
Exactly. That's a good example.
So we're strictly talking about when the property is converted from ag to a non-ag.
Yes.
Can we put that in there somewhere?
Yeah.
Clarify that.
So there's still a provision, ag-related projects are exempt.
So now answer my example, if you would, Counselor. And then in terms of what happens when the little 30 by 30 building wants to be added to the complex?
Under the plan, agricultural structural development, we'll call it for argument's sake, is governed by the Right to Farm Act, and it would have to be approved through public health and safety concern to avoid, to not allow that activity.
And addressed through farm conservation plans?
That's the whole Right to Farm Act process. The plan incorporates the entire process.
Separate track.
Yes.
So Tracy's amendment would have no impact
on agricultural activity, either use or
and the opportunity to enhance their ag viability operation. Her amendment would have no impact.
Correct. It's conversion to non-agricultural development.
Well, that and that's not the intent. I mean, we weren't thinking about ag development. We were thinking about when it's converted for housing development, or and these provisions really are addressing that these paragraphs that are called out in the amendments.
Can we try to insert that language about conversion into this, to make it very clear that it's conversion?
Yeah, yes, if you could come up with some language that would
maybe we should enhance the definition of redevelopment. If we look at what we say redevelopment is, it says the adaptive reuse of an existing structure or structures.
But it goes beyond the redevelopment section. This is what we're going to insert. It's not just redevelopment.
Well, why don't we have the staff work with Tracy and Tim, and others can chime in if they want.
That'd be
but
great.
But now I'm on language that would clarify intent further.
But just can I ask one more clarifying? In Kurt's example, if the farmer did expand his farm or his ag operation fully on his property until it was fully covered with ag structures, at that point, did that whole property then become disturbed? And if there was a proposed change of use, it would be all disturbed area?
If they are structures,
yes.
Page 170 is Amendment 5. It has to do with water resources and water utilities. And the topic is on-site wastewater systems. Our amendment is an Objective 2L2 D. And as I mentioned in my notes on this, this may be a technical correction, and I would like feedback from the staff on this. To use a nitrate target of 1.17 milligrams per liter, not 2 milligrams per liter. So we delete 2 milligrams per liter and insert 1.17 milligrams per liter for the existing community zone within the planning area on a project-by-project basis where we rely on septic systems. Now, if you refer to page 86 of our plan in Chapter 3 and that subpart F, and also earlier in this section, it's discussed that the nitrate targets for the zones are based on the background median concentrations for that applicable zone, also repeated in Policy 2L2. And the nitrate target for the existing community zone is 2. But the background nitrate and median concentration is 1.17 according to the data in our plan. So I would suggest that we should insert 1.17 instead of 2.
And would this be in non-conforming municipalities in the planning area?
I'm not trying to get into that debate. I mean, we can talk about that debate, and if that is the target that we set, then it would be for, through that process, then yes.
That's the good question here, and you answered yes.
Well, it's also
applied to non-conforming municipalities in the planning area.
Yes, it would if we stick with that, yes.
Mr. Chair, it would also apply to all development in the existing community zone.
Can I just respond to Tracy's question to the staff as to whether it is? No, it's not a technical correction. The 2 milligrams was the decision reached. And if you look at our septic system yield map, it only applies to protection and conservation zones. We didn't do it for the existing community because the 1.17 is higher than the conservation zone.
Right.
The result would be, so it would be 16 acres per unit, approximately.
It would be what?
16 acres per unit, approximately, which is greater than the 10 acres per unit in the conservation zone. So we can further discuss this, but yeah, just to answer your question, it's not a technical correction.
Okay, so our statement that we use the background median nitrate concentrations as the basis for the nitrate targets in the zones is not correct.
If we go back to the papers that we get, the technical papers that we gave you on this issue, and when we discussed them, I did look back at the previous meetings. I can't remember what month it was. I think it was April. What we did is we did the analysis for the background nitrates, and then made a decision based on that information. And in the tables we gave you, we actually say, you know, based on the median nitrate, and we give those numbers. But when it comes to the existing community zone, we never put that down. We call that out as using the DEP numbers, because primarily those existing communities are served by sewer, and where they are by septic, staff recommended a different approach than using median nitrate.
Okay. Then I would then, if it's not considered a technical correction, then I will be putting this forward as an amendment, because we feel it's important to protect the from nitrate pollution in the existing communities.
Sorry, Tracy, who's who?
I think all of these are Tracy, right?
If you would be implementing standard that is less than that for the conservation zone.
Yeah, to me that's not so important, and the reason is because, you know, whatever the background median concentration is should be our guide. And we're not going to be doing a lot of septic system development in the existing community zone anyway, so it doesn't seem to be really, I don't think it hinges on that particular issue. I think more it hinges on when we are going to be putting septic systems in the existing community zone, we should be protecting them with a non-degradation policy of the background, meeting the background, you know, not violating the background median nitrate concentration of 1.17.
But what are the median concentrations right now in the existing community zones?
It's 1.17 milligrams per liter. And that's on page 86 of the plan. Okay, amendment 6. This also deals with on-site wastewater systems. It's policy 2L2, objective 2L2E. You know, we've discussed, and I'll just read it first. And new residential development using septic systems, where clustering or conservation design techniques are employed, shall have a gross density for all parcels involved in the development proposal based on the nitrate dilution target appropriate for the LUCM zone, but with the density for the developed portion of the site based on a nitrate dilution target not to exceed 10 milligrams per liter or any more stringent requirement as required by 715. We had a discussion on this several meetings over the last years, and at one point I asked the question of Dan Van Avs, well, what if we, you know, there's a project planned and it shows that they're not going to be able to meet the 10 milligrams per liter at the point of delivery of the water at the tap. And he said, well, you can put treatment on it. I said, well, and then that means that we, as long as you put treatment on the tap, then we would be allowing that development to move forward. And I guess my first question to the staff, is that truly what we intend?
Can we prepare a response for this for the next meeting? Because we didn't prepare for this for today.
Okay.
That's fine. I think that's key.
Yes.
Excuse me, can I ask people in the front to stop whispering, please? Yes. Excuse me. Can you?
Okay. And then the other, so if I have an alternate amendment, I won't discuss it now. If we do not change that, then I have an alternate amendment. But rather than take time on that, let's hear what it has, what we have to say. But I do feel that we should have a non-degradation policy for the existing community zone like we do for the other zone. So then I would put forward a different amendment. Okay. The next one is Amendment 7. And that's on page 170 of our plan again. Same area, on-site wastewater systems. Objective 2L2F, the statement in the plan reads, carrying capacity shall be documented through the land use capability septic system yield map as the number of allowable septic systems per conservation and protection zone, I think it says, for each CUP 14 subwatershed taking account of nitrate target, drought, barrel, and recharge, acreage, privately owned, undeveloped, underdeveloped, and then I have another change for the end of the notes reserved. So the first change in this amendment is to add the existing community zone into the list of zones that would have their carrying capacity set on the nitrate yield, the yield based on the background nitrates. So that would be the first. And I also see I did not underline and all environmentally constrained subzones and bold it. And that should have been bolded and underlined because that also is an addition. We only talk about the conservation and protection zone in that policy. This would add the existing community zone and all environmentally constrained subzones. And that's, again, same issue to protect the existing community zone from nitrate, the development of nitrate pollution, and to have a non-degradation policy in place. And then the last part of that sentence is in the 2L2F, the way it's written is areas that are not preserved, and then that ties in with the next objective, which is 2L2G. And our suggestion would be to delete 2L2G, which allows preserved lands in calculating the septic system yields, and then to change or add the language whether or not it is preserved to the objective above it. And that issue we've discussed, and this issue of whether or not you can use preserved lands and assume that they're going to dilute and not contribute nitrates to your project. So that, does everyone understand that? I think that clear.
But isn't the first change mitigating the second?
Well,
are you including it in the top paragraph and then deleting it from the second, so we're still be including preserved lands?
No. The intent is to delete 2L2G and not allow preserved land to be counted. That's why maybe the language needs to be better, whether or not it's preserved. But the intent is to say you cannot count preserved land. Are you saying it's not clear? Because that's why we're going over these. If there's a better way to express that,
well, I'm reading your first policy.
What it's saying is that even if it's preserved, you still have to, you cannot count it as part of the mitigation, the open land that would dilute your nitrates. And that's because farming practices do contribute nitrates, and we're not going to be able to control that. We have put things into the plan to try to say, you know, we should have farm plans and best management practices that reduce nitrates from farming, but we're not going to be able to legislate that.
Understood, but when I read, it looks like you're including preserved lands in the first paragraph.
I'll look at the language to try to make that clearer if that's what you get out of it, Kurt. It's not the intent.
So what you want to do is do all your septic system yield calculations excluding preserved lands. And when you say that, you're talking about parks, you're talking about
right, exactly.
Fish and game, state-owned properties, preserved farms. Everything is off the map in terms of septic calculations.
Of being able to count that in as an area that does not contribute nitrates. Because we don't know what's going to contribute. And
the efforts that we've made, in the plan to try to limit it is good, but it, there's no quantifiable results out of it. So we, the more conservative approach would be to say you cannot use those lands when calculating how much your subject density is going to be for a development project.
So you can only use developed properties?
Well, you have to look at the area you're developing and count. You can't use that as a way to dilute.
But there's nitrogen loading everywhere. I mean, in fish and game property, every little deer that's out there is popping out molasses onto the ground. You know, I mean, there's nitrogen loading everywhere. There's a certain base nitrogen load in forest. You know.
So we can't assume that we're not getting nitrogen added to the to the property that's being developed, so we cannot use that.
But how is that nitrogen loading any different than the other nitrogen loading? Whether it's preserved or not, how is the nitrogen loading different? How do we differentiate between how does ownership or preservation make it worthy of a separate treatment in terms of the calculation of the septic load capacity? Because there's nitrogen loading in everything that's out there. Homeowners are putting fertilizers on their lawns and in their gardens, or fertilizing their trees.
Right. I agree. And when
golf courses are putting down fertilizers, school fields are taking care of turf, and not that that's a bad thing if it's done properly, but I don't understand how we justify.
Well, what 2L2G says is it says that municipalities can include preserved lands in the analysis of septic system yields in the conservation and protection zone. And if you don't, and what that means is then you get to put more housing in because you counted areas that are open. And we're saying that's not right. That you cannot assume.
Your proposal says that. But on the other hand, you could argue that that property does mitigate the nitrogen loading.
Yeah, but as you just said, there's loading going on all the time
right,
on preserved lands.
But the loading of a deer may be different than the loading of something else.
Well, I think, Kurt, I think you understand the amendment.
Thank you, Councilor.
Mr. Chair, can I just say, can I have a question?
And this is to the staff or somebody. In the existing... anybody. In the existing community itself, you know, one of the reasons why the medium concentration is so low is 1.7. It's because there are really, essentially, no septics in that area, very low. Is it possible to tell us in the existing community zones how much of it is not on some type of town or city wastewater?
We have a map. We have mapped pipes in the ground, existing areas. So right. We have all of that mapped. It's different in every existing community zone. What the existing community zone is a level of development that has occurred. We've captured that.
But it seems to me you're arguing about something that is just so remote to even happen that in existing community zones, people are going to want to put in a lot of septics. And in fact, in most of those areas, you know, there was a great effort and huge amounts of federal monies that went into getting rid of the septics in those areas, if you go back 20 years. So.
Well, our current standard of 2 milligrams based on drought recharge would allow for septics in the existing community zone at approximately 9.4 acres per unit. So we already protect. But what I wanted to just a point of clarification, is to tell you that the mapping that we have done and the septic yield analysis we have done is based on not including preserved lands. But under the new WMP rules published by NJDEP last Monday, they do allow for the inclusion. And that's why we knew that was coming. So we made objective 2L2G to allow municipalities to consider including those preserved lands to be consistent with the NJDEP approach. But we do set forth two criteria that they have to meet in order to be allowed to do that. I just wanted to clarify that as you consider this amendment.
I just want to make one other comment. If we keep including existing community zones and all these very strict standards, you know, where are we going to get receiving areas for the TDR program?
I would just say we're not going to have a lot of receiving areas on septic systems. As a matter of fact, we're really set up to follow this and the smart growth principles, which is to put those where the infrastructure is, according to our plan. So it, I don't think that's going to be. I agree with you. It's not going to be a likely incident. Okay.
Of course, trying to put in a septic, trying to put in public sewer where there are these little septic systems may not be the easiest thing either, right? I mean, we've got some provisions in the Lake Community Zones, I think, where it's a little bit easier. But if you have a small village that needs to go on the public sewer, what's the process? It's not particularly easy, right?
There's criteria set forth in the plan that speaks to failing septics or closely knit septics and concerns over the fact that they may fail. Those provisions are there. Those are the provisions that would allow for them to go to sewer.
So what you have to do is get the septics to fail in these little villages first. So that you can get the septic system first, so you can get the sewer system.
There you go,
you
get an extension.
And there's not enough capacity someplace to release.
Time for the Eighth Amendment.
Eighth Amendment. Refinement and improvement of groundwater resource management. We have 11. We have 10. We have 10. Nice round number. On page 171, this is the same section, but it has to do with the refinement and improvement of our groundwater resource management element. And there are two objectives that I would like to add. The first one is to monitor well water and surface water for nitrate concentrations, to evaluate the background nitrate changes on a HUC 14 basis, and to track new sources of nitrates from Highlands development projects on a site-specific basis. I can explain that a little bit. We don't have a provision in here now about studying and tracking how our develop, as we move forward developing these areas, how the loading of nitrates is going to affect in terms of reducing or elevating the nitrate concentrations. So I think in order for us to be assured, because we're placing a lot of faith in the use of models here, and the model that generated these numbers was based on not a lot of data points. The USGS used what they had. And it makes sense now that we're going to be allowing this to track it and see, is it affecting the background nitrate levels? Are we meeting our targets on a HUC 14 basis? And we have no provision to track it here. So I think we need to have, you know, the belt and suspenders approach to monitoring how the plan is actually affecting water resources, and particularly in this instance, the water quality of groundwater. So I think that objective would allow us to track the nitrate concentrations on a HUC 14 basis from new sources. And then the second one is to track other new pollutant inputs from on-site septic systems and other sources to Highlands waters that result from development projects. The reason for that one is, and that's through actual water quality, real data sampling. And the reason for that is because, as you know, we're using nitrates as a marker. Nitrates are very dangerous in themselves, but they're only one pollutant that a septic system puts, or other development, not just septic systems, but other development puts into the environment. So we can design what the program would cover, the parameters it would cover, but the New Jersey Geologic Survey, for instance, has already developed important parameters that they feel should be tracked. The Wellhead Protection Program addresses some of these issues, but it does not do any tracking. So I'm saying that in order for us to be sure that we're not introducing pollutants that will then take over and become just as important as nitrate, we need to track it and find out. I know we don't have a lot of money, but I think that if we put this into our plan, fund it when we can, and start tracking and getting real data, we're going to have more confidence in how the plan is actually affecting measurable pollution.
Are you saying we will do this?
Yes, the council.
We will go out
as part of our science agenda.
Check these?
Yes. We could hire USGS to do it. I mean, well, there's a lot of programs. Rutgers does it.
Do you have any idea what this would cost? I mean, let's get real. It sounds like an outrageously expensive process.
You want me to go back? And I mean, my organization does some of this, but not nitrates. I mean, I don't know what the cost is. this is what I'm saying is, if we don't have this on our science agenda, if we don't have, and in many of the things that we talked about for our science agenda, we said we're not able to do right away. We're going to do it as money comes available. If we don't have this in here, we're not going to do it. If we do have, and if we have it in here and we can't fund it, well, then we don't do it that year.
I'm concerned we're putting stuff in here that we don't know how we're ever going to fund. You start to almost deplete the integrity of a plan by having stuff in there you know you can't do.
Well, I don't know that we can't do this. And I, as a matter of fact, I feel in order for us to have confidence that our models are working, that the parameters that we've picked to use as our markers are actually valid. And if we don't track it, nobody else is tracking it, we're not going to know.
Could this proposed amendment be something that is done after the plan might be adopted? It's not necessary to put it into the plan now. Isn't it some function of the council's authority to impose this or suggest it later on?
I think that we need to put it in the plan, because I think if we don't put it in the plan, then it's not on our radar. And maybe when we do an update down the road, but I don't see how we're going to start spending money and putting staff time into an effort that we did not plan for in our five-year plan.
The state already requires by statute that every transfer of a house that has a well, that there be a well water test, and every conceivable contaminant be calculated in there. And that's how, I don't know if it came up here or something else I was working on, the state realized, oh, as I read in the paper, the state realized that this company that was doing the well test were falsifying the results because they knew they had hot spots in certain areas, in certain categories, and the houses were transferring, the well tests were coming back fine. So the state's really already doing this. We could just take a look at their information, because they already have it figured out where there is contaminant levels throughout the state. It happens on every transaction, so eventually everywhere would have it done, and you'll be able to track it and see what's going on.
I think it's a good point that the Private Well Testing Act does require this testing, but it only requires it when there's a real estate transfer. And when this development's going to go in, there's going to be a baseline because of that in terms of the delivered water at the tap. There's not going to be any information about Hub 14, which we've based all this planning on. And we don't know when it's going to be transferred again. So it is a piece of information, and I think that's a good point, but it is not, it doesn't in any way
You're then asking that everybody who has a house has to do a well test at $500 a pop every year so you can get it, because that's the only other way you can do it, is to mandate that everybody fill up a glass jar and take it to get it analyzed. And that runs $500 a pop. And quite frankly, that'll be awful expensive.
Well, I don't think that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, then what the state's doing should be sufficient, because it takes an overview of a general area. Housing isn't static. Houses are up for sale all the time, all over the geographic location. And your analysis could be extrapolated for a general area based on what
random.
We know from our science.
Scott,
kind of a random
saying analysis. That we're going to do something and then not doing it, does that expose us to some kind of legal action or lawsuit from groups like Tracy's?
That's being frank. I like
that. What's the time frame?
Well, I think by having it as an objective, objectives are objectives. I mean, so
right.
It,
it's,
so
it's a five-year plan. I have a question.
Yeah.
What does the Act require with regard to, there's something in there about monitoring. There's something in there about monitoring. I mean, it doesn't just say do a plan and ever.
It does say every 6 years we do a re-examination.
Is that all that it says? Is that every 6 year update? It has nothing in there about monitoring.
You talking about
water quality?
You talking about groundwater monitoring?
No.
There's
or water quality in any.
It's part of our resource assessment that we assess all the available data that we have. But in terms of mandating that we do additional monitoring, I don't believe there's anything in the Act to that extent.
It would seem to me that we'd want to figure out whether or not what we've suggested actually works. So
yeah.
It would seem that some level of testing would be important. Mm-hmm. And maybe what you say is as funding is available. But I would, I think you brought the point up about suits. If we have a standard and we say this is our basis, and when somebody comes in and says we were wrong, we have no, you know, information maybe on the ground to say, well, no, this is the way it actually works. And this is what our science tells us. And maybe over that 6-year period, we want to adjust up or down.
Right.
And so I think that we ought to have something in the plan that says we should be monitoring the water quality based on our plan. And maybe it's based upon available funding. I'm not suggesting that we test every house on every occasion, but we use the state information. We maybe send some people out in the, to do some specifics in areas as a test. And we try to stay within ourselves economically. But somehow I think we need some level of monitoring.
Just to be clear, we do have it in here. Tracy wants just to refine what we have. Okay. But we do have, I don't want you to think that the staff didn't think it. It's written to monitor and assess nitrate related impacts, et cetera. And then it goes on to develop appropriate and innovative resource management programs to protect, restore, and enhance sub watersheds. You know, so it is, but Tracy wants it refined.
More specific.
More specific by amendment.
Well, we can talk about this further, but I think the woman understands it.
I think.
Okay.
John, this is your.
I just thought it was important that we have 10 amendments, so I wrote one too. And this relates to the discussion we've had at the last several meetings. It's been under the heading of nitrate standards, but I don't think we've really been talking about nitrate standards, and that's why I was trying to write this amendment. I think the issue that we've been, that nitrate standards has brought to the fore is what is the question, what is the council's authority in the planning area, and specifically in the parts of the planning area that don't opt in, and more specifically that, what is the council's role in terms of other state agency actions that are going to affect the planning area, that are going to affect areas that don't opt in. So what I was trying to do, what I'm trying to do in this amendment is reiterate, but in different language, I guess, reiterate for the state what the law says. And to try to, so what the law says is that towns and counties, municipalities and counties in the planning area do not have to adopt the Highlands Plan. And that's clear, and so municipalities don't have to do that. But the law is also clear that other state agencies take actions that affect the Highlands region, that affect the planning area, and the council in some cases is obligated, in some cases has the option, to provide comments to those state agencies. The question that, in effect, that the other state agencies will be asking is this proposed action consistent with the regional master plan that you, the council, has adopted? And the council is, again, sometimes obligated, sometimes has the option, to respond to those agencies and say yes or no. That yes, this would be consistent, no, it would not be consistent. That applies to the nitrate policy, it applies to every policy, in, or almost every policy in the plan, as it affects the planning area. It's then the responsibility of that agency, so what we've been discussing is DEP, but it could be DOT or any other state agency, to determine how they're going to use the information the council has given. So that agency can say, we are denying this project because of the, I don't think it would be explicitly because it's inconsistent with the Highlands Plan, but because it's inconsistent with these specific policies in the Highlands Plan, that agency could say, we got comments from the Highlands Council, and they say it's inconsistent with the plan, nevertheless we're approving it. And that's where the responsibility lies. So what I mean to do with this amendment is try to clarify this situation that is confusing. I mean, that is two things that are both in the act. One is that the plan is voluntary for the planning area, but the other is that the plan realistically could have an impact on the planning area, on even those parts of the planning area that don't opt in, because state agencies may be looking to the Highlands Plan for guidance in helping them form the recommendation or the decision they're going to make. That's my question.
It's two slides, so I'm just trying to show you.
And there's a little piece of the amendment just to remove two paragraphs that I didn't think said anything. But it was not didn't mean it to be a substantive change. Is that clear?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I received your amendment like everybody else did, and I like it, and it's something that I guess I would support. And I just would like to consider adding two lines, very simple. I take a book or a page out of Tracy's comments. In order for us to be assured, well, I change that around. In order for me to be assured, I would like to know if you would consider, and again, what I'm going to say is probably in here in your amendment, which I'm sure it is, but what I'm going to say is a little different twist to it, simply is this. It is not the intent of the Highlands Council for state agencies to use the process of coordination to circumvent the legislative intent of voluntary conformance in the Highlands planning area. As I said, in order for me to be assured, that's the addition that I would like to add to the very end of your amendment. It is not the intent of the Highlands Council for state agencies to use the process of coordination to circumvent the legislative intent of voluntary conformance in the Highlands planning area.
Could we put that, if it's agreed to, after John's third paragraph, getting these requirements for interaction?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, my initial thought is I would not be happy including, or I'd rather not include that, but I'd be happy. I'd be happy to think about what other people may like that. It seems to me they're twin pieces of the act, and neither has primacy. One is the voluntary nature for the planning. I don't want to wordsmith here, but to take your sense, but take the other side too. Well, it's not the intent of the Highlands Council to have the voluntary nature circumvent the state agency coordination. I see it going both ways. That the act, the act does amend, however many statutes it amends, so the state agency statutes to say this consistency coordination should occur. So I think, while the voluntary part for the planning area has gotten more publicity, the legislature's intent seems to have been both. At least that wording was both. But that said, I just trade with the sentence.
My interpretation of what Glenn has offered is not inconsistent with what you've said. Mm-hmm. It's not inconsistent with what we are saying and what we are doing. So I think it's kind of benign, but it puts a finer point perhaps on the issue that has been said.
More poignant.
Just my thought.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll look at the sentence. Talk about it.
Does this resolve the WQMP problem with?
I think it's clarifying
nitrates.
It's intending to clarify.
Yes, it's just clarification.
Yeah. Other questions?
John, I think you should take out the word system. You saw there's state agencies. I started reading that.
I was thinking it could have been sister or fellow, but I think
that's a pretty census term.
Cute.
It's the brotherhood of woman.
Right. I will agree to take your sister. Okay. So, other questions on the 10th Amendment?
I think it's good.
Yeah, me too. Okay, number 10. This is having to do with future land use, which is part 6. And it's objective 6G2B. I think that's page. There was some confusion, actually, because I was using, in terms of the numbers,
the numbers don't
work. I had different numbers than were in this plan, and then I tried to make it consistent with what's in the plan, so the numbers might be off. In the plan, it's this plan, it's 6G2B, and the numbers I had before were different, but at any rate, the issue is map adjustments. And what I would like to propose is that under that what's in your copy of 6G2B, it reads that map adjustments are prohibited in the preservation area, core forest areas, agricultural resource areas, prime groundwater recharge areas, high integrity riparian areas, critical habitat areas, and significant natural areas. And that would be added to that objective as a qualifier for where you actually could do map adjustments. Concept being that these are the highest of these environmental resources and that they should not be traded away under that section, which talks about map adjustments to the protection and conservation zones or the environmentally constrained subzones of the planning area.
Okay.
It's 185 right. On our plan, present plan. And then the second part would be that map adjustments are allowed only during the plan conformance process and Highlands Council initiated plan updates. I know we discussed this. It's not specifically said in here that this only happens during the conformance process. I would like to ask the staff if that is the staff's understanding, that this only happens during the conformance process.
No, it's okay. Not the staff's understanding that it only happens during the conformance process. Because for towns that don't conform, there may be a need for a map adjustment to come before you.
Okay, so we would like to limit it.
Probably for the reason we were just discussing, right?
Yes.
In terms of council's commenting on state agency action.
Okay. All right. And then also to add, map adjustments are limited to 1% of the total acreage of the municipality. The reason for that is we sort of discussed this in the past about scope. Like, what is the scale of the change? And Tim and I picked 1%. It was, you know, somewhat arbitrary to pick 1%, but it seemed reasonable to make the point that these adjustments should be very small. It's not you're going to take a whole big area in your town and switch it to the existing community zone from the protection zone, for instance. And that overall, the impact on the whole town really should be very small. So 1% is the percent that we picked to, of the total acreage to put forward here as an amendment. And then lastly, to add that, and this goes to the number 3. Which begins, use Highlands development credits or the reduction of the equivalent development yield so that there is no net increase in land use intensity, and add, and demonstrates that it will utilize Highlands development credits to a degree which ensures a level of protection equivalent to no net loss protection, which is discussed further up, and reduces the net impact on Highlands natural and agricultural resources as determined by whether the proposed change affects the protection or conservation zone, respectively, by demonstrating that it will extinguish currently valid exemptions with similarly situated parts of the municipality. And the reason we feel that's important is because the way this is now and what we had discussed at council, it left it open that you could use credits, but you would still there would still be some development attached to the exemption. We would want that total exemption to be extinguished if there's going to be a switching from the protection and conservation to the environmentally constrained, to the existing community zone.
If the exemptions are allowed in the Act, is that those are the exemptions you're talking about?
Yes.
Can we invalidate portions of the Act?
Well, if we can do it through a programmatic program. I mean, like if we bought them, for instance.
Yeah.
We can buy lands. I mean, there's things that we can do. It's not that we're going in and undoing the exemptions.
It's with a willing landowner.
Yeah, with a willing, yes.
Part of a negotiation.
Right, it would have to be willing.
How do we make it map adjustments where something is just wrong?
Well, there's two processes. Map updates are for when it's just wrong. It's a factual update. That is not to be confused with this. The map adjustment, which is a petition that comes before you.
We've got to clarify that in here a little
bit. Clarify, I think it's clarified in the plan.
We actually pulled them apart for further clarification. They were together. We actually pulled them apart to make sure that people understood the distinction. Yes, because you did bring this up.
Right.
We did this.
Because you don't have a verbatim knowledge of the plan in your head.
I do, that's why I really
believe.
It's an open book exam. Any questions about that? So,
John, yeah. We had quite a while ago tasked our counselor with coming up with the equity statement for the plan. So, 1 week to go, what's the status of that?
Well, I did look through the plan, and actually, we included in Chapter 2, if I recall, a set of five overriding principles that address equity in those principles. I can send that to you. So we did it. The plan presently does have equity provisions in Chapter 2, not a specific GPO.
Could I?
So that's a little bit different than what we discussed here, in all frankness, what you were tasked with.
Correct.
You were tasked to come up with an equity statement, and that came out of the fact that our previous draft, I offered language, everybody said, good job, Kirk, but we wish we had a little bit more time to review it. I brought it up a couple months ago, you were tasked with it, it's a week ago, you don't have it. I'm not happy.
If I could ask,
point blank. And I didn't give you any, I didn't ride you on it, I haven't harassed you on it, you guys have been busy, but you let me down.
I think that I should own up here that the staff did draft something that I thought was very confusing, and so it's not in the current draft, so they didn't ignore your request, and but I think, you know, as Tom said, it looked like what's in Chapter 2 addresses what you were trying to address.
So am I left now to devise an equity statement and get it out to everybody very quickly so that we've got time to look at it before the next meeting?
Well, I think staff could give you the language they're talking about, Chapter 2, and see, yeah, and if that doesn't do what you wanted to do, then we can talk about something.
Yeah. Well, we very specifically said we wanted to have a statement.
Right.
A statement's different than goals, policies, and objectives. That's why the state master plan has an equity statement. It's a much different thing.
If I might add, too, it's probably been, what, a year and a half now since I asked for a white paper on how to address the equity issues that have been raised by some of our objectors, and I've been promised it, and been ignored. And I'm not happy about that. I'm not happy about how we've addressed as a council. We seem to have evaded what may have been valid questions, and we had an obligation to at least address them in the context of the law. And I'm very disappointed that we've never done that.
I'm sorry, what questions are you saying?
There were questions raised by objectors. I can't recall now. It's been so long. Who specifically? I don't think it was the farm. Yeah, it was the farm bureau. And request was made and discussed, and I thought we had a consensus to get a response to very specific issues they raise about legalities, and that, you know, we should not ignore them. And I don't think it was an oversight. I think a decision was made by somebody to not address them. There's no other option, and I just want to note that. I've apologized to the Farm Bureau that I did everything I could do to try and get these questions answered, and that's where it ended.
My sense, the draft plan does address those issues and addresses every single other issue that council members have brought up in the course of our deliberations here. There are some answers, some information we provide the council in the plan that is not satisfactory to people who have objections, either to the act originally or to the policies of the plan. But there is still time to add more language to the plan and to make any changes any members feel are appropriate.
Another question. In a build out analysis, where is that in the picture of all this?
It's one of the technical reports that will be, when the plan is released, we said all the technical reports will be released. It is available on our website.
Is it a part of the plan?
It is not in the regional master plan, no.
It's not in here, but when we vote on the regional master plan, we're not voting to approve the build out analysis?
You're not. The technical reports are the basis for this. They are released with it. You are voting on the regional master plan.
Okay, because the question had come up from somebody in a municipality as to the legitimacy of a municipality using, maybe they were only using build-out analysis as an example, maybe it's other technical reports, But can they legitimately use that if we've not somehow approved it? And we don't have to settle that today, but it...
Rich, I have in the plan that towns through conformance utilize the build-out approach we did for our regional build-out at a local level, so we have local build-out. So the plan does have provisions in there regarding local build-out analysis, which will be, the best way to describe it is parcel-based, more parcel-based than the regional build-out is, and more specific to local conditions.
We do make it clear that they cannot rely upon our regional build-out analysis at a local level. It needs to be refined at local level. I want to make sure I say that because I wouldn't want a town to use it and rely upon the information without going further and doing it at refining it to that local level, which is set forth in this regional master plan. Well,
if somebody were to ask me, though, is this build-out analysis a draft or in final form, what would the answer be? Maybe that's not what
the technical report will be finalized with the adoption of the plan.
Okay. Okay.
But isn't it a living document? I mean, we're going to be finding out more precise information as we go from town to town.
Just as you talked about,
I mean, there are open space, publicly owned properties that are not recorded in places that we are aware of that we're going to find that will change the assumptions of that build-out analysis. So.
That is correct.
So you said it would be approved with adoption of the plan, is that
true? All our technical papers are being updated so that they would be released as part of as a technical background for the RMP.
Build-out analysis itself has lots of caveats in it. That it's,
absolutely.
It's a guide and it's final, but it's not
like anything else, it's based on very many assumptions, and as Mina pointed out, some of those assumptions will change with more detailed information, such as map updates.
You use the word approved. I don't think approved is the right word. I think it's
completed.
Released.
It's a document. It's not necessarily.
It's not a draft.
Right.
It will
be released in
draft.
Final form.
Okay. Another question. I'm going to hit on map overlays again. I'm very, very concerned that we can't get a true picture of what we're passing or what we're proposing to pass, approve, without being able to look at the various overlays of the different environmental restrictions on a map of the region. I know we discussed it last time. You said that there's too many overlays to put on there. But I think that it's so important for us to see when we take the buffers and then we add threatened and endangered and slopes and
vernal pools.
Deficit areas. Somebody said vernal pools. And you know, how big of an area does it impact? We color them, and if we say white is the nothing area, how many spots of white are left?
Why don't we identify? I agree with you, Kurt, but I think what you just said, the list that you ran down, if something like that we could take a look at. Would it be possible to bring up the map and overlay it with the steep slopes and the buffer areas the vernal ponds and whatever else?
We could zoom in on an area and we could just layer up the layers.
Maybe if you show us one and then the up.
Yes, we could. Good. It'd be similar to what I showed you on that web-based tool. And I told you what will happen. I mean, just because, you know, just
layer up. But that's my point. If there's no white left, I think we need to know that.
Exactly.
But the no white left is only relevant for those policies that say no developments allowed here. I mean, if the policy is, there have to be design standards or whatever put in place for some of the policies. The fact that it's overlaid doesn't mean.
So let's start with the ones that say no development. And just so we can see what this does actually to the region. Good and bad.
That was the purpose of the build-out analysis. What we did is we said, what was the limiting factor? In other words, looking at all these layers, what is the limiting factor so that we could discern what could be built under the regional master plan? And the limiting factor was the septic yield analysis.
See, I'm just a very visual person. If I want to go someplace, I still look at a map. I don't go on map lists. And so to me, reading it and understanding it, and I'm not being critical of the work, but I think that there is no replacement to seeing it.
I think that that, you know, picture's worth a thousand words. That's why I still shoot 35 millimeters.
Are you proposing this for review or for viewing at the next meeting?
Well, the problem is we're not going to be here at the next meeting, so I think viewing at the next meeting is going to be a difficult thing.
That was my point.
If there are other members that like Kurt would like to see this, I can show them to you.
I think, but the public needs to see it too.
Is that something? Well, I mean, the question was, is it viewable?
Let me see if you want me to do it now.
Let's see if it's doable now, and meanwhile we'll start all the comment periods, and then we could do that. Other comments, questions before we start public comment period, and then we'll come back to something. Okay. Let me say one other thing about next week's meeting, primarily for the public, is that our plan for next week is to have the meeting without a break. And it's conceivable that the meeting might last more than an hour. So one of the many perks we get for being members is lunch, but we don't have lunch for the public. So I would, so we're not going to take a lunch break. So and members will just go get a sandwich and come back. And so I encourage you to bring your lunch or something, but be aware of that. With that said, is there anyone from the public who has not spoken to the council before and would like to? Anyone? Yes, sir.
I stand or sit?
You sit. And try to limit your comments to 3 minutes, and I should turn that. I'm not sure what microphone you should use. Is it this microphone? Can you turn that off?
Is anybody still on the phone?
I don't know. Tim, are you still there? No. Okay, so you can take that microphone.
If you have written comments, they can go.
Well, thank you. First, I'd like to let you know a little bit about who I am. I'm wearing a couple hats today. Tom Byrne, I'm from Middlesex County. I'm Vice President of New Jersey Farm Bureau. I'm also here as a fellow farmer. And I think it's important that members of the Highlands Council know that not only farmers, but landowners throughout this state are very concerned about what goes on here as far as equity and that position that we've taken on this. Obviously, it was the whole state that put together the Highlands Act, and it's the whole state is going to be very interested in what comes out of this as far as equity for the landowners, because if it can happen here, as we've seen other ways, it can go on. You're more familiar with the staff of Farm Bureau, Helen and Nicole. We keep the farming community very informed of what's going on. And I don't think I can say enough for what Kurt has done in representing the farm community. We respect what you have done. This is a hard job that you've been working on. Being here at this hearing, I can't imagine what it's been like to be at these for the last year and a half or so. Though the plan adoption is overdue, the extra time seems to be producing a better planning document than the original regional master plan proposed for the region. We would like to think that this plan will always be evolving, and that those issues that cannot be addressed in the next few meetings can be revisited during cross-acceptance. We expect the council will remain open to revisions and resolving outstanding elements and language that remain in contention. In the closing of this process, there are several very important issues Farm Bureau feels, as most of the farm community, the council should work toward resolving and commit itself to. Foremost among them, as was just discussed, is equity, protection, and funding. We would like to see a statement on equity in the plan similar to that in the state plan. The legislature and the governor need to create a funding source for the Highlands Council can draw to meet the preservation goals of the plan. The current Garden State Preservation Trust system no longer has funding to help you meet your goals. We believe those critical lands the council has identified as needing protection from development should be purchased and paid for. People should not be regulated off their land. The Act itself calls for fair treatment and compensation. We believe the plan will not succeed unless you have preservation funding for the region. To complement the direct purchase of lands, planning tools are needed to protect the critical resources of the region. Those tools include TDR, process of creating critical resources as part of the RMP is less difficult than planning for growth. This has proven to be true as the council could not identify the 4% of the area required in the act for TDR receiving zones. You have not identified any areas in the preservation area for TDR. Even as you are considering shrinking the land available for receiving areas, excuse me, as it stands, the TDR program is not complete, and it will need work to and support by the council along with education and municipalities during the plan conformance process to identify and encourage growth in the areas that can accommodate any region. There needs to be funding of the TDR bank to get the program off the ground. More likely, there will be greater need for landowners to sell credits to the bank in order to meet these resource lands than there will be opportunities for building projects that will purchase credits. The bank must be funded to take advantage of the opportunities as they arise. The program is not ready to do that, even as the plan moves towards adoption. Keeping a strong agriculture cluster provision is important to prevent further fracturing of the farmland base through large lot residential development. As people seek to use their exemptions to build what they can through the plan, it is important to cluster the units to conserve the remaining open land for agricultural use. This is a method that will allow the farmland owner to realize the equity potential of the land without having to sacrifice the use of the land for future agriculture. It fits with the goals and objective of supporting agriculture in the region and should be considered an important part of the plan. Finally, as the plan moves forward, there needs to be strong coordination and communication with the county agriculture development boards in the 7 counties of the region. These boards play a critical role with right farm and agriculture land preservation. They are a resource for the agriculture uses for land, best management practices to encourage farming while protecting the environment. They are also responsible for protecting the agricultural lands in the region by enforcing the terms of the development easements and monitoring the preservation agreements. They need to be included in the process as the plan moves towards implementation. There are many other things we could comment on, and I'm sure Helen will later. You may hear some from other landowners as well, the environmental groups, about changes to the plan before adoption. We know it has been a long journey to get this far. With the inevitable rush to get things done, take the time to get these primary areas addressed. Make sure you have funding to meet your preservation goals. Make sure TDR will work. And use the agricultural experts you already have to partner with you as you move forward to plan conformance. Lastly, do not think once the plan is adopted that you are done with it. Be open to the coming back to and addressing issues that will be stumbling blocks to a workable regional master plan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I put a face to a message that the previous gentleman mentioned. My name is Barry Farquhar. My wife owns 20 acres in Chester Township. As I look around, some of you are appointed, some of you are volunteers, but there are people who have been financially affected by the activities of this act. We are one, just one. Previously, I used to come quite frequently. I got sick and I wasn't able to. But I've seen the parade of pathetic figures who come before you, who have had life savings thrown away. They have lost money. Their future is uncertain. We had plans for this land. We were even offered, the numbers are unimportant. So substantial sum of money for 4/5 of the property. The act came along and the developer disappeared. Now we have land that is almost worthless. We can barely, I doubt that we could even sell it. No mention did I hear this morning. I know you were talking about other things, but there was no mention of this effect upon people, their lives. Nothing really in the act that addresses it. TDR, yes. I wouldn't know what a TDR is, and I wouldn't know how to go about getting it. And I'll most probably be dead before they even take place. I don't know. But there are others that will be alive, I hope. And they should be, their needs should be addressed. I don't see a sympathetic face on this board relevant to that subject. Somebody who is there and is looking after the interests of these people, such as me and many others. It is pathetic. It is a crime. I would wish that you would give consideration to a change in this attitude. Thank you.
Other comments? Elliot Rubin, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I'd like to say that the amendments proposed today by Council Members Carluccio, Dillingham, and Chairman Weingart will result in greater protections of the resources of the Highlands region. Protecting the resources of the Highlands, and it's the drinking water that 5.4 million people in New Jersey drink and rely upon, is after all the goal of the Highlands Act and should be the intention of this regional master plan. I hope that each and every one of the council members will take the time to fully review these amendments with an open mind and in relationship to what it is you have been charged to do. Thanks.
David Schoaf, I'm a Farm Bureau member. I'd love to see the overlays, and I'd love to see the overlays for the entire region. I think they will be shocking if they are ever presented. On the subject of nitrates, I've yet to hear an explanation as to why New Jersey feels it's necessary, and the Highlands Council feels it's even more necessary to deviate downward from the federal standard of 10 milligrams per liter. I have heard no explanation. I think the only explanation I will hear is we're the state of New Jersey and we can do it. I'm going to talk about the Raritan Basin, which is the part of the watershed that I'm familiar with. I'm not that familiar with what goes on up north. And I'm going to talk about this. Water supply availability of the Raritan Basin. Dan Van Adds was the primary author of it when he was working for the Water Supply Authority. The Raritan Basin has 360 million gallons a day available. That is enough in itself for 5,714,000 people. I'm basing that assumption on yet another document. This is from 5033, a permit issued to the Elizabethtown Water Company, which bases their analysis on 63 gallons per day per capita, not 140. This analysis used 140, almost double what this piece of paper says, to come up with the fact that, based on that analysis, they are good with the current water supply system to 2040. They're good till 2040. They have three projects that they could do. One is called the Kingston Quarry. That's good for 65 million gallons a day when it's done. The Confluence Project, which is good for 53 million gallons a day when it's done. The Six Mile Run Reservoir, which would be good for 24 million gallons a day when it's done. That would be enough for another 2.25 million people. This is just one part of the water supply system for the state. 1,100 square miles, that's about 1/7 of the entire state's area. when I hear about water deficits, stuff like that, it makes me laugh. That's a pathetic concept, not substantiated by the state's own documentation. And that's an aside to when this was issued. The Water Supply Authority redid a safe yield analysis and came up with another 14 million gallons a day available, which I have not included in any of the numbers that I gave you. As far as buffers are concerned, I keep on coming back to the Stroud report, a report that is being done by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where they consider boundaries between 35 and 75 feet. They actually take measurements against a, quote, pristine stream and have baseline measurements going over probably 8 years now. No, there's no need to speculate on this. These measurements are being done. I've also noticed, let me conclude with what I've noticed over the years, and I do mean years, that the Tracy Carluccio and Tim Dillingham present to the council rather extreme positions, and we heard a whole bunch more today. And what the council has done over the past, although I'm sensing a change in this, is they negotiate towards these extreme positions. You're showing a little more spunk these days because I think you're starting to get. And this is, quite frankly, this was exactly the negotiating strategy of the Soviet Union. There's nothing unique about this. So let me conclude on a happy note, and I will give you a few copies of things for you to peruse while you're considering water deficit areas. I will give you a copy of this, and I will give you a copy of permit number 5033, which I've told you about several times, and you probably haven't gotten yet. But you will have it today. Oh, incidentally, I have copies for members of the press, too, if you want.
Andy Drysdale, Chester Township. This is number 33, written comments. As of today, it has been 3 years and 11 months since the Highlands Act was signed into law by the previous ridiculous governor of New Jersey. It only took 3 years and 9 months to win World War II. Much was accomplished during that earlier time. Huge ships and aircraft carriers, aircraft and submarines were built and used. I was 6 years old when the war began and 9 years old when it ended. I remember flattening tin cans for the war effort. I saw what can be done when everyone pitches in for a necessary cause. I was 68 years old when Lois and I had our retirement stolen from us, and I'm now 72. It has taken nearly 4 years to create an unnecessary plan that attempts to justify the crimes of the past. The plan is unnecessary because water falls on the entire state and could be collected and filtered. It was reported on NJN News that a company called United Water Company is in the process of building a large water filtration plant. The endangered species excuse is just that, an excuse being used to promote the environmental extremist agenda. Just stop and think about it. With all the land that has already been preserved and all the zoning that was already in place, do you really honestly believe that there are species that are endangered? The only ones endangered are the landowners who have depended on the equity in their land. The $16,000 per acre estimated for TDR credits, or the 70-some thousand dollar estimate for a 3-acre lot in Chester Township, are so far off the mark that it's sickening. Prior to the signing of this egregious act, a 3-acre lot adjoining our land at the end of the road, which we would have extended, sold for approximately $560,000.
we would have had four lots.
Finally, at the last meeting, there was an outrageous statement by one of your members who was on the telephone about not being swayed but by what others thought. Environmental extremists do not care who they hurt while promoting their dubious agenda. Just think of the damage they have done. No Tox Island Dam, no drilling for oil, no nuclear power plants, and theft of landowner equity. Thank you.
Mark Sakutansky from the New Jersey Highlands Coalition. We would like to offer an additional amendment if there's an opportunity for that. I have copies for all of the council members right here, and I will read it aloud for the record.
In the box?
Thank you. I appreciate that. We've been referring to this as a social justice statement. Very simply, it's a statement that, if included in the plan, would provide a greater understanding of exactly what the plan is meant to address. And it's meant to address the need for economic vitality in our state and to provide clean and plentiful drinking water to 5.4 million people. That also includes the economic engine of the businesses that rely on the clean water that's provided all throughout the state. It's not strictly about the people who drink the water from the ground inside of the Highlands, the 800,000 residents of the Highlands, but it's about the entire state and the economic vitality of the state. So the statement would read, and there are a couple different places in the plan where this could go. One suggested place is in Chapter 1 when it talks about different aspects of the plan and what the plan is trying to accomplish. Could also be included in Chapter 2. I will read it out loud. As a matter of social justice, the Regional Master Plan works to reduce differences in access to opportunities, resources, rights, voluntary risks, and the sharing of benefits through changing the form of engagement in water governance to include all stakeholders. Central to the need to adequately protect the resources of the Highlands is recognition of the vulnerable water users most often located in urban areas of New Jersey. Failure to include these stakeholders would perpetuate an historic economic, psychological, and social problem for the health, welfare, and cultural life of our cities. Impacts on the livelihoods of all stakeholders, both inside and outside of the Highlands region, will be recognized and represented throughout the Regional Master Plan. So thank you very much for your deliberations today. I hope you guys consider the amendments that have been proposed very seriously. If you have any questions about those amendments in the next week or so, please discuss them and feel free to discuss them with our organization as well. And I hope you will consider this amendment as well for inclusion in the Regional Master Plan. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Monique Purcell, New Jersey Department of Agriculture. Just two quick comments on the amendments proposed today. One is I'd really like to stress to the Council the need to consider continued flexibility when it comes to buffers. I'm a little concerned about, you know, wanting to keep a very strict, you know, 300-foot and that's it. There's no other changes. We're like focusing on redevelopment areas right now too, which is also a concern. Tying in the functional analysis again, or functional value, I'm sorry. It's almost a circular conversation because to try to minimize or reduce the buffer and maintain functional value will be extremely difficult to do. So I would just stress to the council to really think about those tight buffer widths and without, you know, allowing any flexibility in planning. Buffers really depend a lot on local topography, the soils, and all different types of conditions. It's not just a one-size-fits-all, so I just stress to keep that in mind. The second thing I'd like to say is that the nitrate dilution standards amendments that were proposed today, I feel will have a very negative effect on the clustering provisions of the plan. I think those clustering provisions have been tightened even more so than they existed in November of 07, and I would just caution the council to be very careful about, you know, making those things even tighter. I mean, I think we're concerned now that clustering won't work and there won't be a place to put it. So I think this ratcheting down continually on those standards will make it even more impossible. and then what we'll end up with is large lot zoning or very little area that we can actually focus growth in a reasonable way, in the way that it should be done with, you know, smart growth principles. So just those two things to leave with you before next week's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think one of the few things that I think everyone in this room agrees on is that it's the new fiscal year and we're delighted that you still work for the Department of Agriculture.
Bill Kibler, Executive Director, South Branch Watershed Association. I just wanted to address briefly one of the amendments that was proposed. It was the amendment to propose doing groundwater monitoring, including specifically looking at nitrates. And I wanted to address some of the concerns were raised by Mr. Peterson and some of the other council members. At the South Branch Watershed Association, we have a private and community well testing program that we've had in place for a little over a decade and a half. There are other organizations like mine with similar programs in place that have been around for quite a while. We offer well testing both to our members as well as through a number of the municipalities in our watershed. There are a number of the municipalities that participate in the program. Nitrate testing is relatively simple to do and relatively inexpensive. It's not in the range of $500 to get the lab test done. It's in the range of $100. And the one thing I would suggest is I would think long and hard before I relied heavily on the state private well test numbers, because as Mr. Peterson pointed out, the data is not always reliable, for one. And the other is that it won't necessarily give you a representative sample, which is what you'll need to do a proper scientific study. The good news is that if you have a good protocol set up and you get representative samples, you don't need to test every well. In the Highlands, you can test a relatively low number and get the information that you need. I'll provide some additional information to Ms. Carluccio, but I just wanted to share that with the council members. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the council, my name is James Tripp. I'm general counsel of the Environmental Defense Fund. We support the strongest possible plan in terms of preserving land and protecting water quality. On the other hand, we understand that there's a need to provide equity to landowners. At what level is yet to be determined. That's the reason that we have been working closely with the council staff on developing a strong transfer development rights program. I'd urge just make two comments. One is the council staff has proposed what we think is a very good proposal on a receiving area that consists of about 1,300 acres of vacant land and 1,100 acres of redevelopment. It may turn out to be the case as you go down the road and you begin to look at the sort of the economic issues here and the equity issues, that 1,300 acres is not going to be enough. It will not generate enough value from developers to provide the financial wherewithal to make this program work. In a handout 3 weeks ago, we showed three other scenarios, one smaller but also a 4,000 and a 7,000 acre scenario. I would only urge that there be enough flexibility in this plan so that if you realize that you, as you go through the municipalities, go through the performance process, you need a larger TDR receiving area consisting of vacant land. And I mentioned vacant land because that's probably the land that could be developed most quickly and provide revenues into the TDR bank. That there be enough flexibility so that you can increase that acreage above 1,300 acres, while at the same time still being consistent with the goals and the important mission of the plan. Just one other thought. In this discussion this morning about redevelopment areas and whether the C1 buffers ought to be compromised, a thought is if you are going to compromise those buffers, why not do it to serve the purposes of the TDR program? The staff proposed 11,000 acres of redevelopment land. At the very least, if you're going to do anything like that, why not link it to a TDR receiving area so that some environmental good, i.e. the equity wherewithal to preserve land elsewhere and protect water quality elsewhere and prevent degradation of water quality elsewhere, can be furthered. Thank you.
Helen Heinrich from New Jersey Farm Bureau. I hope that you all will get a chance to look at the summary of where we stand at this point on the plan and a more detailed description of four areas that we still are concerned about. The first one is that this is a Water Resource Protection and Planning Act, and I notice that the Highlands Coalition does not recognize the word planning. They keep talking about focusing on the water resource protection for the state, whereas it's my understanding that the legislature stressed good planning, smart growth, future housing possibilities, economic development, and of course supporting the agricultural industry with a positive business climate, I'm using their own words. So we think that the plan still is weak or skimpy on policies for economic development, and the areas for growth, I think once you see the map, are going to be shocking that they're so limited. So the second area is in the provision for fair compensation. Acquisition is still a big question mark. TDR, as has been said, you cut down the amount of receiving area that's possible, and I think Jim Tripp has a very good suggestion. I hope you will be flexible, because we don't believe that's enough land to cover the value either. Cluster development, you weren't told that today, but some of the policies were direct attacks at being able to cluster on farms. We will certainly be commenting on that before next week. And the cluster development remains the only equity mechanism that anybody can do anytime soon. Ag sustainability, we're very concerned about what seems to be the direction of preempting or commandeering the right to farm process. We don't believe you've had any contact with the Right Farm program, the CADVs on this, and I suggest that you delete the parts of the plans that talk about one in particular, which is in this objective, implies something that is going to be very, very expensive and difficult and maybe illegal as far as the way it's carried out. That's one of the biggest problems. There's also a lack of how do you decide what is appropriate agriculture, compatible agriculture. We've said since day one, who decides that? What kind of process do you have? And do you have anybody that knows anything about agriculture making those determinations? Maybe this could be part of the discussion with the CADB. I'm sure they don't want any more work, but they are a good balanced agency that might be able to help. And you shouldn't adopt it, we think, until you see, like Kurt says, the mapping results. You saw the map that I passed around last time, which shows very little white space, and I hope we're going to see some here shortly. And there doesn't seem to be, as I said, there's a weakness in economic impact. How much is this all going to cost? Certain members of you keep asking, and we don't have any answer to that. And I think communities are really concerned about that, as well as landowners. I wonder if all of the resource factors have seem to have an equal weight, and maybe you need a hierarchy. Maybe you need to just say the ones that are directly involved with water quality and quantity you look at first, and then the others are secondary, because you add up all those layers and you get a black map. And I don't think the legislature intended that every environmental goal of every group should be used as a limiting factor in their plan that they want you to do. Also, could the staff take all the amendments and actually write out what is going to be the effect, you know, what how much more land will be restricted, what the zoning will be changed? I think it would make it clear for everybody that, you know, if you make this change exactly, what the impact would be, and it would certainly help us too. Thanks.
Are we going to be able to do some maps, or?
Oh, yes, we can do the maps.
Okay. Just let me know. Anyone else besides Wilma?
Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Matt's discussed today. First, I think we would definitely support your amendment, Mr. Hart, to clarify the situation about consistency of reviews by the council and the interaction with the other state agencies. We would not want the amendment offered by Mr. Vitrano to be accepted, however. We have some real concerns about the couple of the proposed staff quote revisions that were offered today. The first one, recommend the encouragement of historic advisory bodies rather than requiring them, and just the language about what the bodies might be seems to be totally counter to what our historic preservation experts, expert who I believe is here in the room, has been discussing with the council over the last number of months, that the planning board cannot really be a true historic advisory board, and that there are specific criteria that these boards need to have, and if she comes to the podium afterwards, she will explain this more clearly. Regarding the buffer amendment or that was proposed by the staff, I was really pretty shocked by it. I cannot see any reason why the council would ever want to reduce an undisturbed buffer in a Category 1 stream for any reason whatsoever. It just does not comply with the mandate to protect the water supply in the Highlands. I was even upset about it being like having Category 2, but I mean, this is clearly... it should not be left to the DEP to employ its standards, its minimum standards, should it choose to do so. It's really up to the RMP to have clear standards for the DEP to follow in this case. The other thing is that we have some concerns with the redevelopment process itself that this is evidently somewhat linked to. Right now, the redevelopment areas are not really a part of the regional master plan. They have not been proactively determined to be appropriate by the planning process. It's kind of a walk-in, the procedure that's out for comment right now. It appears to be more like a walk-in thing where a developer can go in and request a redevelopment proposal, site-specific thing. So I think that this could, the combination of allowing the, quote, flexibility in the buffers and having a, quote, flexible redevelopment process could really be a disaster. It would require incessant monitoring by the council without real standards there to base the decisions on. So I would have a huge amount of concern of the combination of those two things. I think I hope that the council will seriously consider the amendments that Ms. Tracy has offered. The ones about water supply and availability are absolutely fundamental to the plan. this plan really cannot be based on allowing development to happen where there is already a water deficit. I mean, it is just a very serious problem, and if the objective is to maintain water supply and development reduces water supply, this just cannot be. I particularly like the amendment that was offered, which clarifies that agricultural land use that does not have structures cannot be classified as disturbed land. That if there's a change of use, that land that has been simply farmed that does not have structures on it will not be classified as disturbed and can therefore not have a buffer reduction associated with that. I think we may put some of our comments in writing for the next meeting. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Christine Hepburn, citizen from Madison and Hardwick. I guess I'm up here to just say thank you for a lot of what I thought were very good amendments. And also I want to strenuously object to the characterization of Councilman Carluccio and Councilman Dillingham as extremists. There's a vast number of citizens out there that are coming from the same place that they are. That's why you have all the environmental leaders in the room. I was going to say making the big bucks. Well, not exactly, but they do get supported and they get paid to try to help do what you're doing, try to help New Jersey's environment and water supply. I would have wished, and I'm very sorry, not to have seen an amendment that would get rid of cluster development on attic soils altogether. We saw an example of how that could be applied, and some of you, I think, liked the fact that it was only 13 new houses added to a farmstead of 135 acres. To me, that looked like not a good regional, when the region's very large, it didn't look like great regional planning to stick 13 new houses in what looked like the middle of preserved and farm and environmentally sensitive land. It looked like bad planning, and although I understand, I think, that you're trying to give something to the farmers, and I support that motivation. I appreciate Mr. Weinger coming out in favor, I guess everyone on the panel, supporting water tax. Obviously, water is not free, and there ought to be some more paying for it, and the farmers ought to be helped, but cluster development and ag conservation zone, I don't think is the way to go. I would hope to see conservation zone be able to be a sending area, and that would help the farmers. I want to especially thank you for the map adjustment memo. That seems like an obvious a fix to the plan, not to have willy-nilly map adjustments. Also, to just make it more concrete for Ms. Letts, I manage woodland and non-woodland property for wildlife, but really for the birds, I guess, and we'll spend thousands and thousands of dollars just removing invasives and doing things that'll help improve biodiversity. And I think it would be a pretty simple matter to take before and after photos and show, you know, invasive removal and native shrub replacement or native tree replacement of those removals and get some sort of credit. And I've told my husband all the money spending someday we'll have a good, actually have a financial impact, but whatever. Thank you for these good amendments. See you next week.
Last comment? Oh, I'm sorry. Dave Pfeiffer?
Dave's been around.
The people who've been here for three hours.
I was at the other master plan meeting this morning.
Yeah. Jeff follows me around.
Right.
In any case, I'm happy to see some of the amendments that were offered today. My name's Dave Pfeiffer. I'm with the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. I think I can say that I could give unqualified support to amendment number two. There really is a need for allowing credits to be given for conservation work on woodlands in particular, as opposed to forest production. Forests have multiple values. These are recognized by professional foresters. They're also recognized by numerous federal programs that are designed to foster good woodland stewardship. Amendment number 8 with regard to monitoring and keeping track of nitrate and other pollution levels within the Highlands region is absolutely essential. You noted in your original reports that you had a paucity of data with regard to nitrate levels. And this is not surprising because you shouldn't expect there to be a well someplace where there isn't any building. So developing a program in concert with USGS, NJGS, local boards of health, county boards of health, to get a more accurate handle on nitrate levels is absolutely essential if you're going to ever evaluate the success or failure of your plan. It is not a crushing financial burden, and I certainly think that it ought to be included as a part of your science agenda. With regard to buffers, very concerned, NANJAC remains very concerned about the buffer variance procedure in the redevelopment areas, particularly because you've got a redevelopment site selection policy that's still out in the air. We don't know where these things are going to fall. We don't know when they're going to occur. But I certainly think that if you have undisturbed buffers within a redevelopment area, that those ought not to be varied, that those ought to be protected and preserved. The fact is that environmental quality is not fungible. It exists where it is. It's not subject to transfer of development rights. You can't transfer environmental quality from one place to another. It exists where it is. A compromised buffer in the middle of a developed area will compromise the downstream segments of that stream. There's no doubt about that. And it may actually be the controlling factor that prevents those streams from ever achieving the goals that you've set up in your plan. So be very careful about that. I would certainly think that removing numbers 4 and 5, as suggested by Ms. Carluccio, would be a good way to go. With regard to deficits, I think you know that we're, as a group, very concerned about the continued development in deficit areas. I think Tracy's amendment that would require that the plan that was put into place to manage that deficit actually be accomplished before new development was allowed is a tough standard, but a very necessary one. I would remind you all of something that happened in the past, sewer bans in New Jersey. We had sewers over capacity, and development was continuing within those areas. There's no reason to consider water any differently from sewer. The point being that if you're in a deficit, we need to see some results before we allow you to further deepen that deficit. We probably will have written comments to you before the next meeting. I'm sure that in your spare time you'll all be able to read them. So, thank you very much.
I guess I'm sort of like telling Thomas at the old White House press conference.
Right.
The last person, thank you. I have been following this closely and reading things, but I was down at the Energy Master Plan hearing this morning in Newark, so this is not the only master plan that the state is working on at the current time. Hi, I'm Jeff Tittle, Director of New Jersey Sierra Club, and I want to thank everybody here for their patience and their long hours and work that's gone on this council over the last almost, I guess, 3.5 years for the council, almost 4 years since the passage of the Act. I know there's been some good things that have gone on where we've cut back on some of the areas of concern on impervious cover and some other things, but there's also areas that I think still need to be improved. And the concern that I really have, you know, deals with nitrates and how nitrates are used within the Highlands. I go back to the early work on nitrate bottles when
Township of Ringwood was sued by a developer in a sort of famous published case called Countryside versus Ringwood. And the main reason that Ringwood won that case was because it was an area that was a conservation area that was not served by, it's conservation area in 1970 state plan, it was not served by sewers and was unsettled. And the concept that was done back then was, what is the minimum lot size you need for a well and septic in order to protect the public health on the people? And what I've seen happen over the last few years is we've kind of twisted the whole concept of the nitrate model to saying to a broad stroke. I mean, even the DEP is doing it. They're trying to apply it to a regional basis versus looking at what's that minimum lot in the middle of the most densely populated part of that sub-watershed. And so when you have a nitrate model, it should be based on, especially in the highlands, because the purpose of the act is to protect, restore, and enhance water quality. You should not have a standard that's set at a standard that will degrade water quality. You have to at least have an anti-degradation criteria towards it where you're not going to make it worse. It should also be applied really more in the different watersheds, because some watersheds will have more or less nitrate levels depending on development patterns. But if we're going to apply it throughout the Highlands planning area, it should be based on not only the average, but what would be the most protective across the board. And that's why the 0.88, was in the plan, seems to be the best way of doing it. If you go to a 2 milligram standard, you will be degrading water quality, especially when you add in non-point pollution. The other area that I have a very big concern about is within the clustering provisions. If you cluster, you can do up to 10 milligrams, which is the highest level that's allowed under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And if you factor in the existing nitrates that are already in the ground, you factor in what's coming from the air. People forget those coal plants in Ohio dump nitrates on us through air deposition. You factor in what may be coming off of the farmland and what's coming off the lawns. You could be putting people at risk. And one of the things that the state looks at when they're setting standards for, like, NPDES permits, they take condition on the ground and the 10, and they factor it in half. So what they would do is, the standard that is set would be somewhere between the 0.8 and the 10. They would take the halfway point. And that's why when you look at NPDES permits, right now it's 5.5, because that's between their target and the maximum. And at least would make it a better way of protecting health. We happen to have real concerns with clustering because, again, you're getting the increased nitrates from the cluster. When you increase development, you actually are squaring your non-point pollution loads. So when you go from 2 houses per acre to 1 house per acre, you're doubling the amount of development, but your non-point load goes up to a factor of 4. And the reason is because you have less land to do renovation and absorption of pollutants. So we still have a very strong concern about the whole clustering provision and what it's going to do to water quality, especially when you're continuing to farm and adding the nitrates coming off the farm fields. Redevelopment, again, is an area that we are concerned about. We think it should be tightened and be a lot stricter. And what gets designated, and instead of the flexibility, should it be served by existing water and sewer? One of the examples I always love to use was West Milford had designated an area next to the Pequannock lands as a redevelopment area to build a golf course. It later was purchased, but just the fact that you could designate a redevelopment area that was primarily all woods, and had it ever been used, it may have been an Indian settlement at one point, but I think that's a real area that we're concerned about.
Wrap up your comments.
I'll try to do my last 2 points pretty quickly. Again, getting back to the capacity issue, we really need to look at how much water is needed for the rest of the state outside the Highlands as we develop the capacity in the Highlands, and I don't think we've done that. When we look at development in water deficit basins, you have to have the water available, otherwise you're making things worse, and I think that goes against the whole point of the Act. So either you mitigate and get the water up front before you build, because if you build and you don't have the water, you're creating a bigger problem. And my last point is on, well, I want to do 1 point first, but they're connected. We've designated only 19,000 acres in the Highlands as basically your no-build areas, which is in a region that has at least 275,000 acres that have been listed by DEP for acquisition seems awfully paltry. To me, it means that those are supposed to be the highest and most important lands, and we think there are a lot more than that in the Highlands. Environmental communities list as about 350,000. But when you compare it to the redevelopment areas and the possible TDR areas, you have 19,000 acres that you're saying are so important in the Highlands to protect, but you have 12,000 acres between redevelopment and TDR that you think are development. I think that balance is way, it should be at least five times more areas for preservation than there should be for development. And then the other point that I wanted to make on TDR is that one of the failures that we've seen in the plan is to really try to designate areas within the Highlands counties that are outside the Highlands for receiving areas. And I think that's a critical, important way to try to make TDR work. And I just want to say that it's, you know, getting this plan to this point has taken a long time and a lot of work, and I do thank you for this. But remember, you know, I was when I was put on the planning board when I was a young 18-year-old, the wise old chairman, who was 45 at the time, said to me, he said, "Kid, if you screw it up, it's going to take this town 40 years to fix it." And just so you understand that what you do next week could take the state a long time to fix if you do wrong to the Highlands. And maybe we would never get it back because we can't get our water supply back. Thank you.
That concludes the public comment period.
Okay.
Can I close it?
Well, we're all just getting ready. What we're going to do here is use the web tool that we showed you at our last meeting to answer, you know, Kurt's request. We will show you at a regional level, but you may find that you want us to zoom in because you will get greater clarity, and so we'll be guided by that. This is exactly as the tool would appear on the website when it goes live. What you're seeing now actually is live. So at least, you know, this is real time. This is exactly what would occur. The layers are coming up on the left, and if when you click on those, some of them then have more within them. You can switch on and off to show any number of layers at any one time. So we'll start with the entire region. Okay, we have satellite, but I think that'll really make it difficult to see. So if we start without using satellite and show you, first of all, the Highlands area, you can see it there. And we don't want to show you planning and preservation because, again, that will cover the entire region. Kurt or anybody, stop me if you want to see something. Okay, so, and we don't want to show you the zones. Again, what Kurt was asking us about were those layers that would limit potential for development. So if we go into open waters, I think, is a good one to start with. Within open waters, we have the streams, lakes, ponds, wetlands. But at a regional level, even when we add those, without even adding the buffer areas, you're going to pretty much cover the region. If we add the open water protection area, which are the buffers, this is what you get at a regional level.
don't want to show you the rest of this is then you can see HUC 14 water availability and we can show watershed values, but again that doesn't get to the question you were asking. If you want to leave that on, we can go to topography and show steep slopes. And again, not all slopes constrain, but the severely will constrain development, so we can add those to it. Remember, these layers, you know, this information is available statewide. Yes, the buffers are ours, but the streams, the steep slopes. If we apply critical habitat, that's the next one. Vernal habitat within 1,000 foot. Now we're keeping all of these layers on at the one time. There's another there, yeah. They're just things get obscured because there's so much information at a regional level. Critical wildlife habitat and significant natural areas. Significant natural areas are your areas of plant life. And the critical wildlife, obviously, we can throw those on as well. So you see that in that sort of pale green, and then Roger will put on the critical wildlife habitat, which is a darker green. This information, the critical wildlife habitat comes directly from the DEP site. Significant natural area is, I believe it's DEP's. Okay. Do you want to layer on preserved open lands and ag lands? No. Yep.
Yeah. How about prime recharge areas?
Well, we can work our way down. Think if in geology, that'll be karst topography.
Yeah, but that's not a no-build.
No, it's not a no-build. Okay. Go down to what's in the underwater capacity. Okay, that's your net water availability. Water quality, weather protection areas. Again, that's not, no, that. It's really for contaminants and discharge. Prime groundwater recharge area.
Looks like there's something everywhere, isn't there?
Well, at this scale, if you just your streams, that's. Yep.
There's a facetious.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is it possible to enlarge the Highlands area without affecting the rest of the valley?
No.
Okay.
But we can go in and do it. We can go back in at the end of this exercise and do it into a smaller area so that you actually see more.
Like a municipality, so pick a municipality?
Yeah, we could. Or just an area. Contaminated sites are, again, from the DP, so we don't need to put those on. They, you know what they all are. So let's not put those on. What's on under potable waters is... public community water systems, you don't need to see that. Wastewater would be the same for domestic sewage facilities. That's what you asked earlier on. Mimi, that's your existing area served. Remember you asked about that? That's all mapped and available here as well. Septic system yield, this is for planning area only, protection and conservation zones, and was the limiting factor as we discovered through the build-out analysis. But we don't have to show those up. Agricultural resources, is not prohibitive of necessarily on its own. Historical, cultural, archaeological, no. Transportation transit, nope. State development and designated centres, no. Transport, nope. And the zoning is just the composite zoning that we pulled together from the entire region. So that's it on a regional level.
How about you pick a town that's fully in the planning area and zone in on a town that's just the planning area?
Okay, so if we go back out, Roger, if you turn everything off and go back out and then put on preservation.
That way.
I'm sorry?
You can't just zone into an area?
Yeah, we can. But I just wanted to turn off all the layers. Because we can build it up so that you can see it.
You have to build it all up again?
Yeah.
You just can't zone it?
Well, you could. But we think it's better for you to see it build up because you see what's happening with each layer.
Would you like to try Mendham Township in Morris County?
Not particularly. I'm sorry.
Are you interested in that?
Morris Township.
Are you only in the planning area?
The whole region is here now. What Roger will do is just sort of as Bill described, go in and pull up the pull up a municipality. What municipality? I believe it was Mendham.
Mendham Township.
Township.
You must be very hungry.
Yes, there is a nice contaminated area.
Okay, so we're in Mendham. Now, you know, again, we have a, I think it's easier to view it without the satellite. So if we go down again, Roger, and start putting on then, I think take off planning area and preservation area again because it covers the whole, we know where we are. Open waters go to the buffers. Well, okay. There are your buffers in, so go down to topography and put on steep, the severely ones. Okay. Yep, put them all on.
Sure. Are these the constraints with or without Aquanet?
This is, our mapping is done blind to the line. These are the resources. There you, now he said, Roger has added the prime groundwater recharge areas. I think that's it.
Could we add the existing preserved open space?
Open space layer, yes. In as you know, again, always with a caveat with all our mapping, as accurate as we have it.
Can you zoom in on Jack's property?
No. There you have it. Okay, we've got open space, we've got prime groundwater recharge areas, severely constrained slopes, open water protection area, that's the buffers, critical wildlife habitat, significant natural areas, the vernal pools with 1,000 foot, and your streams, which are in your buffers anyway.
And hug deficits only come into play.
We can throw on.
It's not a 100% prohibition because they can, unless we were to approve the amendment. So let's put it up there so
okay.
We can see the impact of the amendment.
Okay, we'll go into the. It's water capacity. Okay, now wait. There's different. These are the. It's the red, orange, and yellow. I think we turn on. Those are the deficit areas. So what you're looking at here is you're going to see it all, it's all going to come up, but the red, we nearly need to take everything else off you to see it clearly, but where you see the red, the kind of pinky color, and the yellow, those are all deficit areas.
Okay, so where can they build now?
How about the
it depends
constraint?
On,
how about the constraint? That was also
those 31 constrained areas are not here. We didn't. They are not in deficit now, so we.
But they'll be the blues.
But they would be. Yeah, they would be the which are the blues? The darkest, isn't it? No, it's the lightest blue.
I guess my question is, where could one build?
Right. Well, it is going to depend. Remember that you've got to do the water use and conservation plans, or as it's written currently. The plan allows for a limited amount of development in the deficit areas based on a threshold of 1 or 2% of the available groundwater capacity. Once you reach that threshold under the current plan, there's no more until, and that's with 125% mitigation, there is no more development until you address the deficits. Now, there were amendments proposed to that today. So those, as currently written, there is some limited development up to that threshold in those constrained areas. Some have to do the mitigation in advance of a project, others have to just prove to the satisfaction of the council to get approval of their application.
Well, we don't have exempt property, right? So we don't know what the potential exemptions would be.
You could put the parcel, you could put that parcel layer on.
We can show you parcels, but we can't show you the exempt parcels. But
right,
the exemptions,
yeah, parcels, yeah.
The exemptions still are exempt from all our policies, the Act, the policies, and the DEP regulations. All the single family homes, well, there's 17 exemptions. Single family homes, additions to them, all of those exemptions. The redevelopment to 125% of the original footprint.
That's there now, opposed?
No, we can't show you the exemptions. We can show you the parcelized mapping. He has to zoom in to show it to you.
And Kurt, whoever asked for the planning area, I think it was you, Kurt, who asked for the planning area in his
spelling? I think I should go.
Yeah, this is a community that is entirely within the planning area. Right?
This is correct.
So what we're talking about indicates what exists now, but the ability to develop and build depends on, to a great extent, whether or not the municipality opts in and conforms to the regional master plan when adopted.
That's correct.
So there is perhaps more buildability, to use that, than there now than there would be after conformance.
Yes, that is possible. The very nature of this plan is its protective nature.
Exactly.
When just one little, when we have been going out on informational...
There's not much now. Sorry, there's not much now.
No. When we have gone out, Tom and I have been going out on informational meetings to the towns, we have been showing them, not in this format, but we have been showing them this information, the different layers, and how it affects their municipalities. Much more in more recent months, because we had developed a municipal file, so we were able to share that with them. So we have been very open with municipalities in sharing this information, because we believe that it is valid information to make their decisions, whether or not they conform to this plan. The information is valid information.
And useful.
And yellow? Useful. This is, sorry?
The yellow.
The yellow are...
It could be water deficits.
Deficit areas, it's the, okay. Yeah, the lowest of the deficits, the most minimum of the deficits.
So
where could they develop?
Well, let me just answer a little bit of that question. Based on two studies that our environmental commission did 10 years ago at least, we did a determination of water quality and water quantity availability. And we're all entirely on septics, except for a small portion in parts of the town. And so as a result of those two studies, which were partly funded by the DEP through a grant, which we had to match, Mendham Township decided that we would take the large lots that existed at that time and we would change the zoning so that further development beyond a reasonable area, but remember, could not take place. And we upzoned or downzoned, however you want to call it. Lots that had 5-acre zoning, for example, available to them, were made 10-acre zones. Lots that had 1-acre zoning were up to 3 acres. Lots that had 3-acre zoning were up to 5 acres. So on. And we constrained development to an enormous extent simply by doing that, without having any other constraints. And based on the reports of the Environmental Commission of the municipality, which were very diligently done, and the interests of the municipality itself. This was long before anybody could spell on it. So I just point that out to you as something of significance, and it's very interesting now to look at all the data that has been compiled here and is overlaid on this municipality to see that ain't much left.
This is true, but when Mimi said where can development occur, under the current regional master plan, there would be a septic yield, and you know, we could talk with the municipality about where that yield could be used, and those areas that are in deficit, under the current plan, again, they could build to a certain threshold, but even under Tracy's amendment, what Tracy is saying is address the deficit, and then.
Right.
So I'm just trying to be fair to what is and what may be.
That's right. But there's no place until it comes into back, you know,
yeah.
Until the deficit is
addressed.
Sponged.
But it looks like there's no place that they could just go in and build without having to do some type of mitigation.
Well, first of all the exemptions are exempt from all of this. Okay, so beyond that, if this town were to conform, this is part of the conversation we'd be having with them, but I would say that there is some development potential. Limited.
Roger, could you just turn off the water availability? Because that was showing color
everywhere. Yeah.
Right. I think we realized that's why the act was passed. We were using everything up.
But we don't have.
Now you see some areas that aren't constrained. If you put the mouse around and just show, like, you know, areas that don't have the streams, the buffers, and there's like lot, dependent on whether those lots can be.
Why did you say there's no zoning on this map?
Well, the parcel lots are there, but you're correct. The zoning is there, but then the zoning might be changed in terms of conformance to the regional master plan.
Exactly.
What we have is existing zoning, but and composite. We can measure together.
So the white areas would be potential.
Potential. Some of them, and they may be developed. I mean, the point, and I mean, you can see that they are from some of the streets, but there may be further potential there. Yes.
They show right now. That shows some existing single-family homes at white area.
Yes. Again, when Roger had the parcels on, it doesn't say which are undeveloped and which are not, and then neither does it show you which can be further subdivided. It doesn't show. But there's the parcels. Okay. So the
data from this map is. What
days? Yes. Roger.
I mean, it varies. Parcels are from 2006, depending on where we got the information from. A lot of the information we got was from the land use land cover data from DEP, which is dated 2002.
So it's a combination of 2000 and 2006.
All the way up.
Yeah, it goes all the way up. I mean, and you can go all the way up to the aerials, which are 2007. It varies.
It is the best available and most recent we could get at a regional level. Is that okay?
Thank you. Now we have to teach Kurt how to
do it. Well, I can do it. I just want everybody to see it.
Well, okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was not only interesting, but Clinton Township is one of those planning area communities that is going to be considering reforms. So it's interesting to see that in that context as well as the just in general.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you, Roger.
Anytime. Impromptu performance. Any other matters anyone wishes to discuss today?
I don't know if we want to get into it today or the next meeting, whatever. But this legislation passed the assembly bill was A500. I forget what the Senate bill was. Has it been? Anybody knows? It been signed by the governor?
No, it's being signed. It's actually, I think, scheduled to be signed next Thursday.
Okay. There is mentions of responsibilities or authorities or something from the Highlands Council in there. We haven't heard anything about it. And I've not read it. I mean, this has been reported to me, and I think we ought to be aware of that. Maybe it affects what the regional master plan should be. I don't know, but is there anything we can be told today off the cuff, or should we get some? First, a regional regional obligations.
We thought we sent you a memo, actually, on...
You did?
No, people are shaking their heads.
No, I think so.
We can double check that, but we'll send you a memo on it.
And on the Career Extension Act as well.
Just explaining, if you could dig that up.
No?
None of us remember what the body is.
Did you send it, or Tom sent it? I'm pretty sure it was sent, but it may not have
someone. Some people have I can go right now and check.
I'm looking specifically for what it says relative to the hires.
They're both ready, so we'll send them to you right away.
Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn? Is there a second? All in favor? Opposed?